Hello, and welcome to episode 43 of the New Generation Project podcast, where we the of a mania and analyse the architects of attitude in looking at the dark ages of the WWF, the mid-90s. Today, we witness the feud between The Undertaker and Mankind step up a level as they try to cover each other in 6 foot of soil. It's in your house, buried alive. My name is Stuart Brooks, and look, I don't care if they've been offered more money by another podcast. I own the rights to those characters, damn it, so we'll just recast them. Look, we'll just do it, it'll be fine, no one will notice. I'm joined today by new Paul Scrivens.
At WrestleMaths.
And new Adam Wykes.
Boobs. Hairdos.
How are you both doing?
You first, Paul.
What?
Hey? don't talk over me.
Sorry, I don't mean to steamroller everything you say.
Well, don't.
Have I told you what I had for dinner yesterday?
No.
It was actually a mug of tomatoes with cheese in it.
A mug of tomatoes? That's crazy.
Yeah, I'm not too bad, thanks.
Good, good.
Probably me next.
I'm drunk.
Yep, seamless. Nobody will be able to tell. Nailed it. Actually, how are you both doing?
I'm on a wave of euphoria.
I think we can probably work out why, but Adam, are you all right before we get into that?
Yeah, I'm not too bad. It's quite late to be recording a podcast, but I guess that's probably my fault, actually.
Don't blame yourself, Adam.
I'll try not to. Apart from the remnants of a cold, I'm okay.
Okay then, Paul, go into it.
Well, today's been a magic day in the history of cricket, with Australia being bowled out for just 60 in the first innings of the fourth Test match at Trent Bridge.
Which I gather is the shortest first innings in Test history.
Quite remarkable, less than 20 overs.
And also the only time extras has been the highest score in a Test match for an innings?
An Ashes Test match.
An Ashes Test match,
third or fourth time in history. But yeah, it's quite remarkable scenes. I mean, I switched the radio on at 11:30, it's just like... Just heard the Ben Stokes catch, or the remnants of the Ben Stokes catch. Quite something.
Well, yeah, because I kind of looked at the clock and it was 11:15 and I thought, shit, the cricket's on. So I turned on the BBC app and started listening and there were 10 for 3 already. I thought, what? What's going on here?
I got back about midday and asked him how the cricket was going and I thought he was joking.
Yeah, it was like 50 for 9. It was like,
what?
Yeah.
Really?
It was just one thing after another. It was just remarkable how... Because quite often you get these little... bursts, and you know, England will get a team, you know, 23 for 4, and you know, somebody will build a partnership.
Yeah.
But this was just magic, and of course, Stuart Broad, magical figures of 8 for 15 equals my best bowling figures now.
I'm sure that's what he was aiming for.
Well, his were all caught in slips, I think, whereas 7 of my 8 were bowled, and one was caught at short leg.
So, what you're saying is that you're probably better than Stuart Broad. On your day?
Well, that day was some time ago, but I was playing against a team that only had 10 men, so actually I took a higher proportion of the wickets available.
So you're better?
I wouldn't say better, I'm just it's probably not a direct comparison. I mean,
but mathematically your stats were better?
Oh, definitely speaking, mathematically. But, you know, to be fair... I probably had some tougher opposition to bowl against than the Australian top order at the minute.
Fair enough. And we're actually off to Nottingham tomorrow, aren't we, gentlemen? By the time you good folks hear it, it'll be long in the past, but... Yeah.
I'm hoping that we're actually going to be able to watch some cricket, you know, more than about 3 hours or something. It might take them feasibly to finish the whole thing up.
Well, we're only 4 wickets down, so I think England should bat a good portion of tomorrow, hopefully.
Yeah,
that'll at least be interesting then.
Well, I'm really quite excited to see what England's attacking middle order will do, how aggressive they'll be, if they'll just bat like a normal Test match, or if they'll really try and punish the Australians.
What did Root finish on?
120-something.
Yeah.
Bloody hell.
Not out.
But they put in a night watchman, which says we are serious about scoring more runs tomorrow.
And I think what would be great if Mark Wood could get a nice little cameo of 30 or 40 would be great.
And we're going to spend the whole day in the pub, basically, aren't we? Just watching the game.
Yeah. Well, this is kind of left over from Paul's birthday, really.
Woohoo!
We thought we'd take him to see some cricket. Unfortunately, tickets for the Ashes were just astronomically expensive.
And you've got to book them about 8 years in advance.
Yeah, so we're going to a pub called the Trent Navigation.
Okay.
Which should have like a... they call it their Burning Bale and Ale Festival. So it'll be showing cricket all around the pub, and they've got like a beer festival on and food and live music after it, and it should be really nice.
So since the last time we recorded, actually, both of you have had your birthdays. Did you enjoy them?
Yeah, I had a fantastic day. Had a lovely meal out in the evening.
Grill stock again. We've plugged that 2 episodes in a row now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a great one myself. Got some great gifts from you fine two gents there. I got a nice box of beer from the Baby Scrivens, which was remarkable.
He chose well, considering.
It just goes to show you that some people don't value age testing.
Yeah. No.
Some organisations really need to step it up.
But the selection was spot on. Really nice selection of craft ales from around the world.
I pride myself in educating my child about that kind of thing.
You've done a good job.
But I've also got to say a big shout out to Adam, who got me a range of fantastic presents, but in particular two things stand out. One of them is a picture of Jet from Gladiators, which is now my living room confusing all of Mrs. Scriven's friends. And secondly is a mug, which is pure genius. It's got a picture of me on one side with a particularly amusing face and a cat on the other.
That was a genius set of presents.
I'm glad you liked your Alan Partridge box.
He certainly raised a smile.
How are you?
Yeah, very well. Enjoying a few well-deserved, I think, days off of work.
I think so, yes.
Been reading Titan Shattered by the History of Wrestling chaps, which is a very interesting history of 1996.
Has it taught you anything?
Yeah, there's some quality pieces of information in there. A lot of stuff I've kind of researched for the podcast, but really, really well put together, really well sourced. Definitely recommend it. If you picked up Titan Sinking and like that, I'd thoroughly recommend it. Daniel Bryan's autobiography I've been reading as well, kind of about two-thirds into that. He's just got into WWE. Again, very interesting stuff. I think my bar for autobiographies is set very high in that I love Brett's book because it's so vast and so detailed. And Brian's isn't terrible. It's certainly not in that, you know, sort of gold dust million dollar man range of autobiographies that are quite bad. But I'm a detail person, as you may have noticed over 43 episodes of this. Mm-hmm. So I like minute details. There's a good amount of detail, but I could stomach more. Maybe they've been cut out or maybe he just doesn't remember. I don't know. But it's certainly an interesting tale.
Now, I've not read it, but I have seen that it's got the little flick book feature of the biography in the bottom corner. So when you flick through the pages, Brian comes up, walks onto the page and does the yes taunt.
Which is genius.
Which is brilliant.
Speaking of minute details, I used to have a pet newt. And
what?
This genuinely true. Yes. I had more than one. But I had one that was called Tiny. Do you know why I called him Tiny?
I don't.
Because he was minute.
This is actually true. That wasn't just a joke. He did own a newt. Well, two.
Yeah.
In the fish tank of death. In the Paul Scriven's fish tank of horrors, where you had lots of lovely, lovely fish and then dropped a massive predator in there that ate them all.
See, we went round a garden centre the other day, didn't we, that had an aquarium in it, and we thought, have we ever told the story on the podcast of Paul's fish tank?
Did you see the vampire crabs there? Because that's the garden centre that I often go to.
Right. No, not that I recall.
Yeah, they've got some cool vampire crabs that are purple.
Wow.
They're only little.
We saw some plecos, and one was particularly big, and I said to Stuart, look, this is the type of fish that Paul had until it died. It never really reached fruition of full size.
Have you seen, they have some massive ones in. I've seen some about 60 centimetres, I think.
This one was
yay big.
You're gesturing.
I'm gesturing.
Perhaps just over a foot.
About a foot, yeah.
Speaking of vampires, we watched Lucha Underground, Ultima Lucha, earlier as well, Adam.
Yes, it genuinely shocked and amazed me.
What an incredible... I mean, saying season finale when you talk about wrestling sounds kind of weird, but
yeah,
that's what it was.
From the offset, the idea that, okay, this is going to be a wrestling show and it's going to be done in seasons like a TV show and it's going to have an end and then there might be a second season and stuff, sounded to me like not a good idea. But actually, upon watching quite a lot of it, it's absolutely fantastic. And you can build up massive storylines. I love the cinematic quality of it. It's fantastic.
And for the most part, I thought, in-ring-wise, it delivered the finale. The Tejano Blue Demon Jr. match was only about 3 minutes long and nothing, but the rest of the card really, really delivered.
And they've really pulled in a huge wealth of great talent off the indies, and obviously they've got some big names from former WWE stars, like, you know, Del Rio and John Morrison and people like that. So you've got recognisable faces, but they've also taken some of these guys off the indie circuits that are absolutely fantastic and put them in the mix as well, and it just works so well.
And that final 5 minute ending cinematic, whoa.
Yes, it had an epilogue. Had an epilogue of the season. So you see what's happening with the characters and where the, you know, how they end up, and it makes you want to see what happens next. Yeah, what happens next and where they're gonna be next season.
I think if they don't get a second season, I might cry. Which is why I've started a hashtag, second series you shits.
Well,
so
fair enough.
If you want to tweet the El Rey Network with that, I'm sure they'll appreciate it.
Speaking of wrestling things, what was the thing that you showed me the other week, kind of the Triple H-based thing?
Oh, Wrestling Isn't Wrestling. Paul, you watched that for the first time the other week.
That was genius.
Yes, absolute genius.
Very, very
have we discussed that before? But
I think we've mentioned it, but yeah, if you've not seen it, Wrestling Isn't Wrestling, find it, watch it. It's brilliant.
One thing I want to plug before we get started with today's episode is something you may have seen us reveal on Twitter and Facebook over the last couple of days. Earlier in the year, when we released the Scrivens 3.140, we offered a Total Divas review as a bonus to those who chose to purchase. We had a number of people inquire about obtaining that episode separately, but as we promised it as a T-shirt exclusive, I felt that we kind of shouldn't go back on that. It was the right thing to do after we said that's what we were going to do. In addition to those queries, we've also had a number of people inquire about whether we had or would have a Patreon where they could donate to the show, and I gather that's something other people have kind of done, but we've not set up. Well, kind of in light of those inquiries, we've recorded a second Total Divas review, this time covering the episode titled The Double Cross, that is now available over at selfie.com/newgenpodcast for only $1.99. Obviously, the episode isn't essential to the timeline that we're covering, so you're not missing anything vital from a show, but instead it's a little bonus that allows you to give a little back to the show if you wish to do so, helping us to pay for hosting the show and stuff like that. If you need an additional incentive to check it out, Mrs. Scriven sat in on the recording and chimed in with her thoughts as she saw fit.
Yeah, I'm feeling slightly nervous about this.
What, being released to the public?
Yeah.
Well, my next note says, ever wonder what Total Divas star Mrs. Scrivens would swap Paul for? The answer may shock you to your very core.
Yes. Startling revelations.
The slightly worrying thing is I think she meant it.
Oh, completely she meant it.
There was no duplicity in the way that she said it.
And it was a very quick answer as well. She knew instantly which one.
And Randy Orson wasn't even in the show.
No, not at all. So if you want to check that out, head over to selfie.com/newgenpodcast. Pick it up for $1.99. Any and all purchases are greatly appreciated. Following the WWE's rapid attempt at a complete disassociation from Hulk Hogan following his racism scandal, this week's challenge to you, the audience, was to come up with a new tagline for the show to replace the Honour the Heroes of Hulkamania and Analyse the Architects of Attitude 1 that we've used since way back in, I think it's episode 3.
It's something like that.
It's definitely not on the first couple, but I'm pretty sure it's episode 3.
I remember you busting it out fairly early. I mean, that's
I recall coming up with it. I was just walking home from work one day trying to come up with a tagline in my head and that kind of popped up.
It's good. Has it kind of run its course now because it's marred with...
No, I mean, there's an element of humour to this. I don't think we'll drop it entirely, but I thought it would be a good comedy thing for people to suggest. But people came up with some really good legitimate suggestions as well. So the suggestions we've got here are sort of a mix of humorous ones and legitimately well-designed suggestions. So the following are our favourite suggestions. James Wolford. Hello, and welcome to the New Generation Project podcast, where we talk about the racists, drug addicts, alcoholics, and sexual deviants who somehow managed to pave the way for the biggest boom period in the history of wrestling.
Hmm.
Not wrong in the slightest.
No, well, when you actually stop and think about it, disturbingly accurate. Armando Fuentes.
It's a great name.
Great name. Hello, and welcome to the New Generation Project podcast, where we honour the victims of the clique and analyse who got to wear main event pants in their wake.
I like that.
Yeah, I genuinely like that.
Yeah, that's a very good one.
I do think it just sums up our show.
Yeah, who got to wear those pants?
Mike Ashdown. Hello and welcome to the New Generation Project podcast, where we honour the hitting of Hick and appreciate the all-roundedness of Atherton to view the dark ages of English cricket, the mid-90s. Very good, although I don't know if I might have gone for a different, so, you know, all-roundedness of Atherton.
It's got the alliteration, is the thing.
It has, which you specifically asked for. Yeah, I wonder if there's somebody else we could... Because Atherton did bowl a little bit. I think he bowled a few leg breaks until his back gave in.
I'll also like to bring up that Graham Hick and Graham Thorpe were my, like, personal favourites as a child.
Well, they were talking about Graham Hick today on the radio, comparing him to Steve Smith.
Okay.
From the Australian side.
Yes, I did catch that, actually.
Saying, you know, he scores lots of runs on flat tracks against, you know, slightly less quality.
They're talking about like Waka Yunus and people like that, weren't they?
When it comes up against the high-quality opposition and moving pitches, he struggles.
How does it feel, lads, to introduce the podcast? Because I think that's the first time you will have said hello and welcome to the New Generation Project podcast.
Yeah, it's an interesting feeling, yeah.
I feel power.
Nick B. Hello, and welcome to the New Generation Project podcast, where we adore Adam Bomb and Ahmed Johnson, tolerate temper tantrums from Shawn Michaels, and wish a clothesline from Bruce Hart on our enemies.
Again, that sums up our... People are really just getting down to the number of what we're about.
The essence. And also, I do adore Adam Bomb.
Yeah, so, I mean...
Really, probably about the most underappreciated person, maybe, that we've seen.
Probably not.
Bob Holly.
When was the last time we saw him?
In Your House 1.
In Your House 1?
Yes.
David Light. Hello and welcome to the New Generation Project podcast, where we're all about Tatankas, Tanakas and Sonny's Maracas. So sit tight and enjoy maths, mullets, moolahs and mantars. Aha!
Plenty of alliteration and Partridge to finish off. That's wonderful. I'm going to have to read this one very carefully, Connor Ennis. Thank you. I wonder what if Ahmed Johnson did your intro. I'm not going to try the voice because I can't.
Oh, please.
No, I really can't. I just don't know. I can't even imagine what it sounds like. Hello and morecome to the Moo Domination Object Outcast. Here we armour, or Amor even, sorry, the hippos of Axelmania and analyse the dynamite of Mattitude. My shame is Stuart Crooks, and I'm coined bouquet by our Berry Moan people's belt holders. It's your going down, Wall, Gibbons and Madden. Pearl River Plunge Wives.
Worst Ahmed Johnson impression ever.
But very well scripted, though.
If anyone wants to do that as an impression, completely in a non-racist way, feel free.
Yeah.
The problem is, those words don't make sense next to each other.
So it's hard to read.
So it's genuinely just hard to read.
Chris Walsh. Hello, and welcome to the New Generation Project podcast, the home of cricket, applied mathematics, Bruce Springsteen and Alan Partridge. On this episode, Paul will be unable to pronounce, insert wrestler name here, and insert noun here. Adam will shake off his hangover long enough to make a vile, disgusting, confusing comment about Sonny, and I will ask you for a 5-star review in iTunes. So kick back for the best 2-hour podcast that is occasionally about the period in wrestling history that the internet seems to have forgot happened.
Very good, very good.
I wouldn't say that I make vile comments.
I would.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'd second that.
Eric Ortiz Torres, also a very good name. Hello and welcome to the New Generation Project podcast, where we honour the heroes of the Big Boss Man's first run and analyse the architects of the Big Boss Man's second run by looking at the dark ages of the World Wildlife Fund. very nice.
Is that where something became extinct?
Al Snow's dog.
True. Ash Preston, hello and welcome to the New Generation Project podcast, where we analyse the architects of monkey tennis and look at the dark ages of the pedestrianisation of Norwich City Centre. I hadn't appreciated how long a word pedestrianisation is until you see it written down.
Joseph McCormick, hello and welcome to the New Generation Project podcast, where we watch the glitz and glamour of the Golden Age fade and witness the birth of a new attitude. I like that one.
That is really good.
Yeah, very clever.
Well, what was the name?
Joseph McCormick.
Good name.
Nick Henderson. Hello and welcome to the New Generation Project podcast, where we bask in the resplendence of the WWF's greatest mullets and analyse the hairdressers of Attitude. Oh, and there's like some wrestling stuff in as well, probably. Very nice, very nice.
That seems to be a recurring theme in here as well.
They think that we don't talk about wrestling.
They're probably right.
Matthew Glenn. Hello and welcome to the New Generation Project podcast, where we honour the heroes who dress like bulls, bin men, race car drivers, yetis, and those who screamed about the rare white Bengal tigers, and analyse the mullets, masks and main event pants of the dark ages of wrestling, the mid-90s. All of this plus confusing our American listeners with Alan Partridge and cricket references.
Fair enough. The first 5 minutes of today's episode.
Yeah, plenty of that today.
Sam Fagans. Hello, and welcome to the WWE Network History Podcast, where we talk about how WCW tried to run hard-working men out of business, Triple H started the Attitude Era all by himself, and all of ECW stars were stolen away by Eric Bischoff. Sounds about right.
Raymond Gallant. Hello, and welcome to the Family Ness Podcast, where McToot blows his bagpipes while Elspeth and Angus watch those notes go floating across the waves.
Somebody's been listening very carefully.
Yeah, harkening back to the family nest there. Very good.
Marcos XCX.
Yeah, that's the name he's given.
Okay. Hello and welcome to the New Generation Project podcast. I wonder who got the power back. News.
That really will confuse anyone who hasn't watched Alan Partridge.
Yeah, that will sound very odd.
Gary Ellard Thurtle. Hello, and welcome to Youth Hostling with Chris Eubank. As will that.
Yes.
Alex Queller. Hello, and welcome to the New Generation Project podcast, where we pay homage to mullet mania and test the limits of acceptable carnival food to be poured down a woman's breasts. Viewer indiscretion, discretion, is advised.
You realise what that's a reference to, right?
I'm guessing custard.
It was the time you wanted to throw hot custard down, Sonny.
Lukewarm.
You said hot at the time. Yeah. Have you revised it to lukewarm?
I've revised it in the thought that it would do more harm than good.
You also didn't do your sexy voice.
Well, I don't have a sexy voice. Come on,
try a sexy voice for viewer indiscretion.
I think lots of people would probably disagree with you don't have a sexy voice. I'm sure lots of people think you've got a very nice voice.
Hashtag Adam's sexy voice.
Right, this one could take some time, guys, so if you want to just nip to the shops. CJ Fleck. Hello and welcome to the New Generation Project. I didn't even get through that bit. CJ. Shut up. CJ Fleck. Hello and welcome to the New Generation Project podcast, where we deplore the dodgy prodigies of wrestling's prodigious progeny and explore the excellent exaltation of extreme exertion.
Fucking
not
hell,
bad.
He did it
well
first
done.
Time.
Oh, I'm the king.
I'm genuinely impressed. I thought 45 minutes of this podcast would be that. Dan White. Hello, and welcome to the New Generation Project podcast, where we wish we'd never watched King of the Ring 1995 and Uncensored 1996.
Damn right.
Fact. True, yeah. Yes.
Tyler J. Light. Hello, and welcome to the New Generation Project podcast. There will be no refunds.
Nice.
it's direct and to the point.
Jared Groves. Hello and welcome to the New Generation Project podcast, where we go through the hearts, times and undertakings of WWF's mid-90s.
I thought you'd appreciate the punning.
Yeah. Very good.
Everybody likes a pun.
Dwayne Adams. Hello and welcome to the New Generation Project podcast, where we marvel at the bemulleted past while gazing forward to a future etched in stone. Sullivan, my son.
Did I tell you I saw a white tiger when I was in Tenerife?
No, you didn't, actually.
I don't know if it was rare or white.
Bengal.
So I didn't know it was white, I saw it. I didn't know if it was rare or Bengal, but I did see a white tiger.
And without giving away any spoilers, I was mildly disappointed at Ultima Lucha when it turned out that Pentagon's master was not, in fact, the master. Or even Kevin Sullivan having been slightly promoted. Because from watching the Dungeon of Doom, I gather, sort of, ranking-wise, master came above Taskmaster.
Yeah, he was in many ways the architect of the whole movement, wasn't he?
The master delegated to the Taskmaster, who would set specific tasks.
Taskmaster was like middle management.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. He's basically that guy in Office Space who walks around to everyone's desk.
Take your concerns, Kamala, to your line manager, the Taskmaster. Gregory Dale. Hello and welcome to the New Generation Project podcast, where we honour Pat Tanaka in a mask and analyse the architects of what was wrestling thinking. Very good.
Two Scrivens catchphrases there.
I forgot that many catchphrases.
Tons. Absolute dozens.
Brilliant. Andrew Scythe. Hello and welcome to the New Generation Project podcast, wherein we tackle the tragedies... Oh, I thought I was so clever getting through that other one as well. Andrew Scythe, hello and welcome to the New Generation Project podcast, wherein we tackle the tragedy.
That's another one of your catchphrases.
Yeah, where you can't say words.
Where I'm an absolute bloody idiot. Andrew Scythe, hello and welcome to the New Generation Project podcast, wherein we tackle the tragedies of Taka Michinoku and seek sunny days on Skype. That's how it's spelled, honestly.
Just about.
And finally, James Couture. Hello, and welcome to the New Generation Project podcast, where we wistfully pore through pay-per-views piece by piece in a knowing nod to the notorious 90s in an attempt to ascertain the advent of attitude.
Lovely.
Alliteration.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah, another fantastic set of suggestions. Thank you very much, folks.
Really clever ones.
Some very clever ones there. And we may end up using some of them in future episodes and stuff, so thank you very much.
I was talking to Adam about this the other day. I think we have some very intelligent listeners to come up with some very clever things.
Yes, they often do.
Well done, people.
Was that slightly patronising?
No, it wasn't at all. I don't know how people come up with this. If you sat me down and said, come up with a better idea than that, I would not come close.
It's Sunday, the 20th of October, 1996, and we are live from the Market Square Arena in Indianapolis, Indiana, in front of a crowd of 9,649, including 1,411 comps, for a live gate of 135,605. The show drew a 0.4 buy rate, approximately 100,000 buys, for a company gross of $798,000. For some reason, this VHS didn't come with the free-for-all attached, so we sadly miss out on a match between Justin Hawk Bradshaw and The Stalker that apparently went 20 minutes dead on.
Who the hell's The Stalker?
We'll discuss him on another episode.
Okay.
For the record, The Stalker picked up the win. But 20 minutes for a free-for-all match,
yeah.
That would make it the longest match on this card, I think,
and plus,
bar the main event.
Plus, the last one that we saw with Bradshaw, he didn't really have many moves at this stage.
So what's he going to do for 20 minutes?
Yeah.
Maybe The Stalker's amazing.
Stalker's not amazing.
Oh.
My whole existence is death, darkness, and the destruction of you, mankind.
I have a vision of you, Undertaker!
I must be your judge, your jury, and your executioner.
I have a vision of you, Undertaker! cry for mercy. I'm finding only vengeance.
Why don't you try and imagine what those last few breaths of air will taste like?
A vision of you, Undertaker, with soil filling your lungs.
Try to imagine what it will be like to never rest in peace.
When vision becomes reality, I'll laugh myself to sleep.
I am going to bury you alive. You have been sentenced to eternal damnation.
Opening promo focuses on the feud between Mankind and The Undertaker and their Road to the Buried Alive match. It's pretty cool and links into the In Your House logo, which this time is appropriately a gravestone that splits in half. Oh Fortuna hits, and it will sadly always remind me of Mabel now after your sterling job at King of the Ring 1995.
Mabel Fortuna, yeah.
Now, that reminds me of a scene from the young Sherlock Holmes. What? Have you ever seen that?
No.
A programme that when I was young and watched it, I thought Sherlock Holmes might be fun. It was terrifying, genuinely terrifying.
So this opening promo, anyway?
This opening package, I thought, really good. Again, nice and slickly put together. By the way, they seem to have discovered some colour filters now. So we've actually got different colours for the two people. So there's like a blue wash for The Undertaker and a red wash for Mankind. I guess symbolising the fact that Mankind's the heel and Taker's the
neutral
face. Yeah.
Well, blue's neutral, presumably.
Red is angry and violent, I guess.
Yeah, and was blue's a bit more
calm.
Yeah, calm.
Think back to those first lessons of media studies, Adam, when you were 14 years old, and we watched The Outsiders.
He's got a blue pen. What
does
it mean?
He's got a blue pen. What does it mean? Yeah. And the light coming through the windows is golden. What does that mean? What does that signify? What does that symbolise?
What does it symbolise? I wasn't there. I didn't do media studies.
Peaceful?
Yeah. I don't know. I can't remember. It's half a lifetime ago, basically.
Yeah, we are talking a long time ago.
Is that what really happened in your media studies classes?
I distinctly remember that lesson.
Yeah. I think that may very well have been the first one.
Like, I'm a bit of one of these. I think a lot of that stuff is just by accident. And I've always said this.
Filmmaking in general, just by accident.
No, I don't think filmmaking is by accident, but I think sometimes people read too much into it. Oh, he's got this colour pen. Well, perhaps they just had that colour pen knocking around.
I can't remember thinking that when I was a teenager. But then you think it does make a difference. If the guy's got... Because the pen's quite prominent. If the pen's blue or the pen's red, it does make a difference to how you view that character in terms of the whole makeup of the scene.
To be fair, I don't think I've watched that film since we were 14, so I can't really remember. Stay gold, Pony Boy.
Although that's, generally speaking, maybe true. I bet there's been plenty of instances throughout the history of film where people have read stuff into things in films that have just been completely innocuous.
Undoubtedly, but you'd say that about...
Anything.
About music as well.
You say, that was genius. Yeah, genius there. He did that there. It's like, it was just a muck-up.
Or read loads of things into lyrics, which, you know, probably the words were just there to fit a rhyme scheme or something.
So applying your own meaning to this opening promo, is this a match you think can carry a pay-per-view, even one of these shorter ones?
Oh, definitely. I think you, like, Undertaker's already, you know, he's right up on the top tier, isn't he? And, you know, so it's like it is an event to see an Undertaker match. And I think Mankind's proved himself over his shorter stay in the WWF that you're going to get a good match out of him. So I definitely think this deserves to be at the top of the card. Plus, you've got this odd gimmick, which hasn't been seen before. So I think a lot of people would be thinking, well, what's going to happen in that?
I think it's absolutely in the right place at the top of the card. I think this is a very intriguing match.
Vince McMahon, alongside Jerry the King Lawler and Jim Ross, welcome us to the show. JR doesn't have a working microphone and looks pissed off instantly. Vince graciously gives JR his mic, as he is the obvious babyface here.
Obvious, yes. Mm.
So having not seen the Raws, Paul, what did you make to this dynamic that goes on throughout the show between Vince and JR?
I didn't get what was happening, really. It was very odd, and this is the thing, not having seen the connecting points.
Well, lucky for you, I've got all the background here for you.
Good, because I was just very bemused by it all.
So something we touched upon when we discussed Mind Games was Jim Ross and the return of Diesel and Razor Ramon. On the September 23rd Raw, Jim Ross left the announce booth, walked to the top of the stage, sat on the entrance ramp, revealed a Stone Cold t-shirt, sat cross-legged, and said hello to his friend Colt Cabana. Okay, so he didn't actually do that, but he did head to the ring and cut his own pipe bomb, a term which, incidentally, I agree is much overused now. In the process of revealing the new Razor, Ross regaled his personal history with the WWF and perhaps more importantly, its owner, Vince McMahon. Ross told of how in 1993 he had left a job with the NFL's Atlanta Falcons to be the WWF's primary play-by-play announcer, but was soon bumped from that position by the egotistical owner of the company. He told of how he was fired following his first bout with Bell's palsy in February 1994, but was brought back following Mr. McMahon's indictment in the summer to call Raw, but was fired once again once Vince got his get-out-of-jail-free card. Ross then claimed that he was hired back a second time, this time to work in the organization's front office, and that the rotating door of talent over the last year was not an accident, and that he had been very busy. Ross then bought out the fake Razor Ramon to much disappointment from the crowd, who was quickly attacked by his childhood friend, Savio Vega. While the reveal would cause boos, Ross would actually generate tons of big babyface pops throughout this promo, particularly when he claimed to be the best play-by-play announcer in the whole damn business. Adam, you saw this promo. What did you make to it?
Well, I thought it was really good. It was believable, probably because
it was true.
It was very, very true. And I think that JR delivered it with a good deal of enthusiasm. I think that people reacted very well to it. It was interesting to hear Vince being spoke of in this way at this point in time.
Yeah, because obviously, for the most part of what we've seen, bar a couple of random asides here and there, he's not been identified as the owner of the company.
No, he's that guy on commentary, and Gorilla Monsoon is in charge of things.
This is very tenuous, but it sounds to me that this is the very beginning of the Mr. McMahon character, in that sense of creating that hateable boss, because if he's being a dick to JR.
The funny thing is, I don't think they think Vince is the heel.
No, I think it's played as in Vince has done the right thing and
isn't JR a whiny bitch?
Yeah, JR's the disgruntled employee with no real reason for it, because actually Vince has done him a real big favour by keeping him in a job, even though he's got this facial paralysis.
Well, we'll get to that.
Yes.
Ross's commentary on subsequent weeks' shows would become more and more bitter, with Ross defending the new Razor and Diesel as being good young athletes, while the other announcers and WWF president Gorilla Monsoon would call Ross out on the fact that he hadn't brought back Scott Hall and Kevin Nash. Ross would confusingly continue to play babyface announcer on Superstars at the weekend, but would accompany Diesel to the ring for his bout with Mark Merrill on the 7th of October Raw, as well as progressing Bret Hart's return angle to the WWF, meaning this entire heel turn is weird, to say the least. Having had Kevin Kelly as the lead announcer for Raw the last couple of months, one of the hooks for audiences to order this show was to see McMahon commentating alongside Ross, given the new direction of his character. So Ross versus McMahon is kind of, in a bizarre way, being promoted as a feud on television.
Wow.
Given the new shooty feel of the World Wrestling Federation, it would be remiss of us not to mention the debut weeks of WWF Livewire.
Now, I'd not heard of this before. I think you said that when I would remember Livewire being on television, later on it would have been a completely different format.
Yeah, so the show, which you may remember, it was latterly a mere highlight show for Raw. It was, you know, just one of those sort of Saturday morning, one-hour things that showed, oh, this happened on Raw, this happened on SmackDown, that kind of thing. Do you remember the title? I think it ran to about 2001. Anyway, it debuted on September the 21st, 1996, and began life as an interactive show for fans to call, fax, or email in questions or opinions. Hosted by Doc Hendricks alongside Jim Cornette and Sonny, the programme openly discussed both ECW and WCW, as well as kayfabe storylines in the WWF. The most notable episode came on the 5th of October, when Vince McMahon himself appeared as a guest. Before McMahon appeared, Doc was interrupted by Vince Russo under his WWF magazine writer guise as Vic Venom. He also sported a cracking mullet, eh, Adam?
A 4-star, yes.
Only four star.
It's not quite a 5-star, but it's a very good effort.
Venom immediately outed Hendricks as being former Fabulous Freebird, Michael P.S. Hayes, with Hendricks responding angrily that Venom wouldn't want to run into Michael P.S. Hayes and he was now Doc Hendricks. McMahon's appearance would mostly focus around his feud with Ross, with McMahon consistently dodging Vic Venom's questioning about whether he was a better broadcaster than Ross, before putting over his side of the story regarding Ross's departure from the WWF. The most offensive part of the show came when Vince and Vic Venom discussed Jim Ross's Bell's palsy after Ross had called in and blamed McMahon for the affliction due to the stress that Vince had caused him. Vince congratulated himself for allowing someone with Bell's palsy to appear on television, while Venom mocked Ross for having one eye up here and one eye down here, and basically said that nobody would want to see somebody who could only talk out of one side of their face on television, and that nobody with Bell's palsy should complain to him because he just doesn't care.
It was really weird to see and to hear that. I don't know what they were hoping to achieve by this, because they're the sorts of comments that I think ultra heels would make, because it's actually really offensive.
Yeah.
But they're not playing themselves as ultra heels, are they? I think
Vic Venom is kind of supposed to be a heel, but Vince genuinely thinks like, oh, no, other companies don't allow people with Bell's palsy on television, so JR should be thanking me.
Yeah.
Is this one of the things where we're so removed from, you know, the mid-90s now that we forget how much society's changed and how comments like that would probably be so easily glossed over back then, whereas things...
I guess, in a way that, you know, you kind of didn't see people with afflictions or disabilities or something in those sorts of roles that, you know, you would today, but still, I mean, it even stands out as, really, you think you're the good guy for doing this?
Mm.
Yeah. There's also, I guess, there's less of a sounding board for the general public, isn't there, in the mid-90s. Like, now it's very easy for if someone does something offensive, there'll be, you know, a massive thing whipped up over social media.
Say if you happen to leak a sex tape with you making racist comments.
Exactly. You're done for. But that just wasn't here at this point in time, so I guess probably a lot of people were offended by it, but didn't have the voice to actually let the company know that it was offensive.
When the show switched to live callers, most of whom were plants with questions designed to further WWF storylines, one caller identified himself to be Bruce from Connecticut. Bruce asked Mr. McMahon if it was true that he was copying all of his ideas from ECW before telling the studio team to shut the F up when they interrupted him. Any idea who Bruce from Connecticut was?
Bruce Pritchard?
Well, that's the joke, but who was it actually?
Paul Heyman.
Bruce from Connecticut was, in fact, Paul Heyman from Philadelphia and was quickly taken off the air. But as with the ECW interference at Mind Games, it was kind of well played, I thought, and felt real enough to not be instantly dismissible as staged.
Yeah.
If you've never seen this episode, it's really rather surreal, but worth watching and remains in its entirety on YouTube. So I'll probably post it on Facebook at some point.
It's quite short. It's not going to take up a massive amount of your time, but it is just really interesting to watch.
Very, very odd.
Yeah. Hmm.
Our opening bout is Stone Cold Steve Austin versus Hunter Hearst Helmsley.
Well, that's a promising start, isn't it?
Steve Austin continued his verbal tirade against Bret the Hitman Hart on the 23rd of September Raw, when he provided guest commentary on the bout between The Stalker and Hunter Hearst Helmsley. Austin claimed that he spit on the life, the career and the family of the Hitman, and that he would get a reaction from Bret, even if he had to fly to Calgary and beat up his old man.
Mm-hmm.
On the September 30th Raw, following a King of the Ring rematch between Austin and Jake the Snake Roberts, Savio Vega would leg it to the ring with his trademark leather strap to make the save for Roberts, who Austin was continuing to abuse. Unfortunately for Savio, who was originally scheduled to be in this match, he gets bumped here for some unnamed injury, apparently suffered during a tour of Puerto Rico. Meanwhile, this bout marks Hunter Hearst Helmsley's first pay-per-view bout since May's Beware of Dog. Serving the collective punishment delivered to the clique as a result of the curtain call in Madison Square Garden, Helmsley did little of note on television until Mr. Perfect began stealing his valets. This storyline, which actually began at a Raw taping in April, was picked up again in September, initially on Superstars but eventually graduating to Raw, and was basically the same angle repeated a number of times. Helmsley would come out for a match accompanied by one of his women. Midway through the bout, Mr. Perfect would stroll out, have a short conversation with the lady, and subsequently walk backstage with her. Helmsley would get distracted and lose the match. This would include defeats to the likes of Psycho Sid, Savio Vega, The Stalker, and Freddie Joe Floyd.
Hmm.
Yes, I saw that.
Helmsley would tire of Perfect's shenanigans on the September 30th Raw. He would march to the ring, demand the presence of Mr. Perfect. He would challenge Perfect to meet him in the ring, with Perfect responding via picture-in-picture that he accepted, with the match scheduled for the October 21st Raw, the night after this show. In the meantime, promos began airing on WWF television, hyping the return of Mr. Perfect, with footage taken from the old sports vignettes and shots of the Perfectplex. Jim Ross even went as far to say Mr. Perfect returning to the ring was like Michael Jordan returning to the NBA. Ensuring that there was an issue with both competitors in this bout, on the 13th of October Superstars, after Steve Austin interfered in Savio Vega's bout with Salvatore Sincere, Mr. Perfect would get into a verbal confrontation with Stone Cold that resulted in Austin leaving the announce booth. The 14th of October Raw would see Perfect cut one final promo, hyping his return to the ring before causing Helmsley the aforementioned loss to Freddie Joe Floyd, while the 20th of October Superstars would see him steal one final valet from Helmsley before their match.
Mm.
A lot of stuff about Mr. Perfect there. Not a lot about Steve Austin and Hunter Hearst Helmsley going against each other.
Yeah. Because I've seen a few of these matches where Triple H gets distracted and then loses. I do wonder what is Mr. Perfect saying to these women that makes them so readily just leave
with
him.
And in like 10 seconds.
Yeah.
Even more bizarrely, on one of the Raws I noticed, Kevin Kelly actually makes reference to there being a Mrs. Perfect. So not only is he stealing this guy's woman on national television, apparently his wife's watching it.
Weird.
I do think perhaps we should get people to let us know what Mr. Perfect might be saying, what his chat-up lines might be.
Yeah, that might be a good one.
The most killer chat-up line ever.
Well, I presume he would have the perfect chat-up line.
That is a fair point, yeah. Mm.
The entranceway is an awesome graveyard with a big metal gate.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, I mean, I really like set. The one complaint I've got about this, though, is the lighting on the show seems very dark to me. And I didn't know if this was a tonal thing that they were going to capture the kind of graveness, if you like, of the event, or if it was just poor lighting. I don't know what you thought, but I thought it was really quite
dark.
Noticeable. Yeah.
I think it's deliberate to give atmosphere to the graveyard set, and it means that you can't see that much of it all the time, but the bits that you do see do look really good.
Plus, it's kind of a dark pay-per-view tonally.
Yeah, I mean, I did wonder if they could perhaps just put a few bits of pyro just around the graveyard bit.
Like some Catherine wheels on the gravestone, that sort of thing.
That kind of thing.
Triple H enters alongside a lovely-looking blonde lady, although her nose almost rivals his.
It's harsh.
I didn't notice.
Yeah, she definitely had a prominent proboscis.
Proboscis?
Is proboscis nose? Am I remembering that right?
There's a proboscis monkey, isn't there, which has got a massive conch on it.
JR moans about his non-working microphone.
Standing by right now, ladies and gentlemen. Kevin Kelly, along with a man who's about ready to lock up with Hunter Hearst Helmsley, taking Savio Vega's place. There he is, Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Certainly is ready to go, Vince. I'll tell you what, Stone Cold, Savio Vega now injured. Does your game plan change now that you get to face Hunter Hearst Helmsley?
It doesn't change my game plan one bit, because I already said Stone Cold's got a list and everybody's on it. There ain't a damn thing wrong with Savio Vega, and I know that for a fact. I give Hunter Hearst all the credit in the world because he's got the guts to step in the ring with me. As far as Bret Hart coming back for Monday Night Raw, I hope it's to announce his retirement, because if it's not, then Stone Cold will retire him, and that's the bottom line. As far as anyone having a problem all of a sudden with the language that Stone Cold is using, well, they can just kiss my ass,
all right,
and that's
I
the bottom
we
line.
We have had enough of that.
Backstage, Kevin Kelly is with Stone Cold Steve Austin. Kevin asks Austin if his game plan has changed from Savio to Helmsley. Austin isn't too bothered and runs down Savio, but gives Helmsley some props for facing him. He brings Bret Hart into the conversation and says that if anyone has a problem with his language, they can kiss his ass.
Good stuff.
Stone Cold says that he has a list and that everybody is on it. What's the point in the list? Just go around attacking random people.
Have you never noticed that's his entire modus operandi?
Yeah, but why go to the organisational depth of having a list about it? If you're going to do it, have a spreadsheet.
I don't think the promo has quite the same impact if he says, Stone Cold's got a spreadsheet and everyone's on my spreadsheet. Plus, you would keep a list so you knew who you'd stunned and who you hadn't.
I'd perhaps, if I was going to do it, I'd do a spreadsheet and have some kind of conditional formatting on there and some statistics. But
I think Stone Cold Steve Austin would have been a very different character in 1996 if you were booking him.
That'd be true.
Stop swearing, Steve, and get your spreadsheets out. You'll go down much better.
Interrupt people and have more anecdotes about cats.
The proper Stone Cold theme hits, and I popped hard for it.
I didn't, because I missed it. I was too busy typing about how annoyed I was at the commentators talking all over the announcers.
Yeah, that is irritating.
Did anybody else get really fed up really quickly about the whole microphone thing?
No, because and I guess it's because I perhaps had more context into what was happening with it from seeing some of the Raws that Stuart had been watching.
Possibly. I mean, even though you've explained it to me, I still think I found it quite tiresome. I thought it hurt the match a bit.
Do you not think it was, on occasion, really funny?
There were some kind of intriguing bits, but I felt it was a little bit like the... You know, going back to the WrestleMania match with Goldust and Piper again, where they needed the match as a backdrop, and it felt like it was almost falling into that category. Because what's taking the main feature of this match is the commentary duel. And actually, that's what I was focusing on a lot of time, rather than the ring action.
But back to the theme, this is the first appearance of the classic Stone Cold theme.
It's a great theme, isn't it?
It is a fantastic theme.
It really
theme.
Fits the character that he's kind of cultivated for himself.
I knew he must have it soon, because I knew he had it at Survivor Series, but I hadn't quite placed it to this particular show.
Is he there now? Is he the Stone Cold that we know? He's kind of got the moveset. He's got the waistcoat. He's got the beard. He's got the theme.
Well, this is the list I've got. Over the last several months' worth of shows, yeah, we've noted the evolution of the Austin character. And I do think with the debut of the theme tune, it's pretty much complete. The goatee, the catchphrase, the waistcoat, the colourful language, the sign language, the theme, they're all there.
The beer.
The beer drinking doesn't really come in until, like, 98, I think, when he's mega babyface. But the main aspects of the character, I think, are there. All together now. The finishes there, like I say, the theme's there, the jacket's there. He looks like Stone Cold Steve Austin. Austin jaws with some fans ringside, as JR tells us neither of these men are overwhelming fan favourites.
Do you not see that? Because there was some kid, it was like
Undertaker, and there was Shawn Michaels.
But it was like a 14-year-old girl or something who just screams fuck off at him. Harsh.
I didn't see that, but did you see those two dressed up? There was like a real bad dressing up effort, and one was Shawn Michaels, one was The Undertaker.
No, I just didn't spot that.
Just kind of on the corner that there was a little bit of interaction with, and I thought, gosh, turning into a fatal four-way.
But I thought it was interesting, JR, saying that neither of them were overwhelming fan favourites, as Austin gets a huge face pop.
Yeah, I mean, people have realised, haven't they, over, you know, the past few months, this guy's got something, so he does actually have a backing.
JR's mic drops out once again as well. Vince is rocking the spectacles tonight. Does he often do that? Have I missed that?
Not often.
Helmsley tells his lady to stay put. Triple H gets an arm drag to open and poses to a decent amount of heat. Austin leaves the ring to jaw with some, what I've got down as, fat guy. But there's some discussion as to the gender of this person.
I thought it was a fat girl with a moustache.
See, you thought it was a bloke as well, didn't you, Paul?
Oh, I went for chap.
I'm willing to believe that it was a chap.
I'm positive there was facial hair, though. Definite facial hair.
Because King says that he thinks it's a woman. That's definitely on the commentary.
Okay. Technicians try to fix JR's microphone. Lawler speculates that, yes, the fan is a woman, and laughs when he gets corrected. Austin gets back into the ring and responds with an arm drag of his own and some sign language to Triple H.
Oh, is this the sign language about him being number one or number two?
Yes, Lawler, quote, maybe he thinks Hunter Hearst Helmsley is number one. They lock up and Austin grabs a headlock, taking Helmsley down to the mat. He tenaciously holds on and turns it into a hammerlock, but gets elbowed in the face.
One of the things that does happen with the commentary is that as the mic drops in and out for JR, that he starts kind of correcting some of the moves or calling some of the moves and saying, did you know what that was, Vince? Do you know what that was? I thought that bit was quite interesting.
Yeah, it's very amusing. JR gloats over being responsible for Bret Hart returning to Raw the following evening. Helmsley gets a headlock of his own from another lockup and turns it into a hammerlock. Hunter ducks an elbow but gets taken down with a big fist. Clever spot, I thought. Helmsley copying what Austin was doing, but then just getting knocked down.
Mm.
JR claims his faulty microphone is a conspiracy, and the crowd breaks into a perfect chant. Tempers flare with some shoves, and Helmsley tries a punch, but Austin takes the blue blood down again with another big fist. Triple H grabs another headlock, but Austin's aggressiveness quickly gets him the advantage, and he applies an armbar. Vince speculates that one day, both of these men will be WWF champion. For once, he's spot on.
Mm. I've got that JR said that, not Vince.
I thought it was Vince that said it.
It doesn't sound like something that Vince would say.
Well, it's correct, so no, it doesn't. But...
Mm. Yeah, I thought it was JR that said it. I could be wrong.
Austin applies a wrist lock, and JR sarcastically informs Vince what the hold is called.
Is that after Vince has incorrectly called it?
No, I think he just tells him sarcastically. Oh, okay. You know, that's an...
I think he tells him because he hadn't called it, or hadn't called anything.
Triple H gets an eye gouge, but runs into an Austin boot and a clothesline, which yields Austin a two count. An arm drag into an armbar slows the pace down for Austin, and Vince constantly no-sells JR's taunts, which doesn't make him seem like the babyface at all. It doesn't come across like he's rising above the situation. It comes across like he's just ignoring him to be a dickhead.
Yeah.
Smarmy is the word I'd use.
In his whole sort of, like, role on TV, how often has Vince come across as a likeable babyface type character?
Not often.
I think he just finds it very difficult, even when he's trying. He works so well as the heel.
Helmsley scores with a big knee to the stomach and kicks and punches away at Austin in the corner. But Austin reverses for a babyface pop before he walks into a big back body drop from Helmsley. Helmsley hits a vertical suplex and a knee drop for a two, followed by a back suplex for another two. Helmsley applies a chin lock, which allows us some picture-in-picture of the announcers bickering. Is this what you meant by taking away from the match?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really realise it was that much of a storyline, as you've now explained to me. But I think if you've got that much of a storyline going on, that really is taken away from what the match is trying to show you.
JR asks Vince if he learnt anything from watching him commentate on Superstars that morning. It's a good sarcastic joke.
Yeah.
Austin elbows his way out of the chin lock, walks into a sleeper hold, which he then reverses before Helmsley applies another of his own. Austin hits what is essentially a stunner, which Triple H flare flops for and gets a two.
Yeah, I noted that down as a stunner. Did they call that a stunner on commentary, though?
No, they didn't. Austin drops Helmsley over the top rope and hits his axe handle off the ropes for a two. Helmsley hits his high knee and gets a fist drop off the second rope for a two. Lawler asks Ross if McMahon's one, two, he got him, no, gets on his nerves. Thank you, Jerry Lawler. We've all been thinking that for 3 years.
It is one of the most irritating parts of his commentary.
The crowd pops big for Mr. Perfect walking out in a lovely blue suit. Perfect approaches Helmsley's valet, who is instantly swayed by his perfection. Helmsley attempts to confront Perfect, but Stone Cold attacks and takes him down. Austin also gets in Perfect's face before begging off when Perfect looks to attack. Austin's taunt to Perfect was something along the lines of, "Get the fuck out of my match." When Perfect turns away, Austin throws water in his face and Perfect just leaves with Helmsley's valet.
Well, later on, Mr. Perfect calls it soda, I believe, so it'd be stickier.
Austin rolls back in the ring, only to be attacked by Helmsley. Helmsley sets up for the pedigree, but spots Perfect leaving with his girl and heads off to get her back. Before Triple H can reach Perfect, Austin attacks and looks to suplex him on the concrete, but Helmsley reverses and both men are laid out in the aisleway.
He just hasn't learned, does he?
No.
You know, for me, that was the first really exciting spot of the match.
The suplex on the concrete.
Yeah. And I know you two seem to have quite different opinions of this match to me. I know we're not quite at the end yet, but you guys rate this match and I don't particularly. For me, there was a lot of stalling and lots of filler early on in this match.
I disagree. I thought there was like a good amount of technical wrestling early on and it amped up towards the end. Yeah. But
I think it's pretty smooth and you do have like a bit of reaction because, as we said, Stone Cold's got a bit of a build-up of following. And even though Triple H hasn't been on pay-per-view in ages, he still gets a good heel reaction for doing his taunts and things. People still hate him. They hate the character. So I think this match actually works quite nicely.
Well, I've got to be honest with you. I mean, I can't disagree with you in terms of, yes, the crowd react quite well in the right ways to both characters, I feel, here. And I can't say that the wrestling is bad in terms of its move. I just didn't find it exciting.
Helmsley is up first and looks for a pedigree in the aisle, but Austin reverses and monkey flips Triple H into the ring post, getting a reaction from the audience.
He did well to get the distance in right on that, because he moves him around. As well, Austin's head must only be like a couple of inches from whacking on the steps when he flips him.
Yeah, he had to drag him quite a way to get there, didn't
he? Yeah.
Austin rolls Helmsley into the ring and runs at Helmsley. But Helmsley moves and Austin goes careering into the ropes. Unfortunately for Helmsley, Austin bounces on his knees back off the ropes, flips the jerks in the crowd the finger and stunners Helmsley for the win at 15:30 to a pretty decent pop.
Yeah.
And JR ends the segment bitching about his microphone.
Well, I've written, apparently swearing is cool.
It is. Yeah. This is the late 90s. Do you disagree?
I don't know. I don't quite know how I feel about that because It, you know, it's part of his character. It's so well defined that it feels quite natural. But I don't, you know, if I didn't know the Stone Cold Steve Austin character, I think I'd have quite a different reaction to the whole swearing thing. If you look at that, you know, he will become your main guy.
Yeah.
And it's quite a negative message. Certainly a massive departure from
Lex Luger.
Yeah.
And that's a good point. And I think it would be like, we're watching a very different show now.
Yeah.
And like the Lex Luger isn't being pushed anymore. That time's kind of passed. And I imagine for the audience that's been watching at the time of the time that we've been watching as well, like through 93 through now to 96, it's got to be quite interesting and exciting to see such a different character doing things that you didn't think were allowed to do on television.
Because, I mean, if you think about people like Brett's fairly clean cut on TV, isn't he? Doesn't do too much that's controversial. And even Sean, although he's cocky and has his also hissy fit,
he's a stripper.
He doesn't quite have that in your face brashness. Where this is a different type. This is much more aggressive and in your face.
Yeah, and it's nowhere near as controversial as the stuff that we've seen from Goldust.
But that's what people get behind the character, is that aggressiveness that you just mentioned.
Yeah, and it's, I guess it's, what type of, he's the anti-hero, isn't he?
Oh, completely.
So that's what he is, and So controversy mixed with anti-hero is good. Controversy mixed with homosexual undertones is bad, and they've learnt this lesson.
So do we just need to be much more aggressive?
I don't think so.
I'd love to see you be aggressive.
Will I be much more successful in life if I'm...
Yes, exactly that.
Yeah, if you did that. Not that you're not a winner, but you'd be more of a winner if you did that.
Okay, I'll try that more.
Yeah.
Out and about.
But I quite like the finish, the bouncing off the ropes, because normally if you go careering into the ropes like that, you're fucked. But he sort of bounces off on his knees and he's like, haha, I'm smarter. Flips the bird, does the stunner, finish.
There's a few times that he's done that recently, the whole kind of ring savviness.
Yes.
Which I do quite like. I mean, I think it's a good bit about his character. And there was a couple of good spots in this match, but for me there was too much filler and it was a little bit too long.
See, I thought this was a fine opener and a pretty decent match overall. These two will obviously go on to have what feels like hundreds of matches against one another, and they clearly have somewhat of a chemistry early on, despite it being a heel versus heel match. I want to go on record now, just randomly, as saying I absolutely hate the Three Stages of Hell match from No Way Out 2001 that everyone loves.
Well, I've never seen that. I want to see it.
It just goes on way too long.
It goes on.
How long?
It's like about 40, 45 minutes in the middle of a show.
So what are the Three Stages of Hell?
I can't even remember.
So I used to love playing those matches on the games.
But I'd way rather watch this bout. I thought this, compared to sort of the later matches, is quite interesting to watch in terms of the context of where their characters go.
I thought this was really quite good. On a slight divergent path, when you did a Three Stages of Hell match on the computer games, what were the three matches that you would insert as the three matches?
I'd probably do a Hell in a Cell, a TLC, and then probably another Hell in a Cell.
That's terrible booking.
Or maybe like a hardcore match in there somewhere, but yeah.
I'm presuming, Adam, you did bra and panties, fulfill your fantasy, chocolate pudding
You
match.
Couldn't put those matches in Three Stages of Hell or Three Stages of Heaven. That would have been
brilliant.
Amazing. You could have a Three Stages of Heaven match.
Vince, we've got an idea.
If only it was 2006 again.
Foxy boxing, jelly wrestling, and, I don't know, some kind of custard-based event.
What is it with you and custard?
It just reminded me that, you know, the suggestions brought it all back. I'd forgotten about the custard thing.
Can you make custard from scratch?
Why bother? It's so much of a pain in the arse.
I've always said this. I mean, you can get stuff for what, about... I used to be able to get stuff for 11p from one of the supermarkets, I forget which one. But it was really good, instant.
Yeah, so why bother from making it from scratch? It doesn't really taste that much better.
Well, Mother Scribbins, she always makes it from scratch, and I personally just prefer packet stuff.
Back to the match, diverting away from custard recipes. I'll also say that this match actually really made me want to see both Triple H versus Mr. Perfect and Steve Austin versus Mr. Perfect.
Yeah.
How long is it since we've seen Mr. Perfect in ring?
SummerSlam 1993.
And will we see on our show much more of him?
I don't want to spoil it.
Okay.
Does Triple H learn from his mistakes? Because he's an idiot. Because there's been like five times where he brings a woman out, Mr. Perfect comes out, nicks the girl, even handcuffed her to the ring post.
Yeah, that's the thing that happened.
Well, so I was about to suggest that Triple H does.
He comes out and he handcuffs her to the ring.
So what does Mr. Perfect do?
Comes out with a key.
why has he got the key?
He's in cahoots with one of the security guards.
In cahoots.
Does he learn? Does he stop coming out with valets?
Look, Adam, I'll have you buried for this, because I'll have you know he's the cerebral assassin and the game and all that other stuff and king of kings.
Well, from this evidence, he's a chump, because he does not learn.
I mean, I thought you were going to say, when you're talking about Mr. Perfect, I thought maybe he would come and handcuff himself to maybe her and the ring post.
Achieving what?
Well... achieving that Triple H can't get her off him or the ring post because they're now attached.
This would be a really awkward.
That's an awful idea.
I'm not saying it's good. I'm trying to practically think my way through this logically.
It's, I don't know. I think at the moment that you've lost to Freddie Joe Floyd because of this issue, you'd probably say, right, I'm not coming out with the valet anymore.
Yeah, there is that aspect of the storyline, I suppose.
From the very beginning, it was clear that Billy Gunn was smitten with the vivacious Sonny, while Bart Gunn was less than enamored with her managing skills. Nevertheless, the Smoking Guns did become the tag team champs with Sonny's help. Behind the scenes, however, Billy's infatuation was coming between the two brothers. At Mind Games, Owen Hart and the British Bulldog sophomoric Frank flustered both Sonny and Billy. Throughout the match, Billy seemed more concerned with consoling Sonny's wounded ego rather than defending the tag team titles. It proved to be a costly distraction.
What a dumb move by Billy Gunn!
This could do it! One, two, three, two.
Not only did the Guns lose their title, they lost their manager as well.
And I have had it! You two are fired! Do you hear me? Fired, fired, fired!
Tonight, both Guns want the tag team title back. Bart for the gold, Billy for the girl.
All right, gentlemen, momentarily, you are on a quest to become four-time WWF Tag Team Champions. But, Billy, if you don't mind me saying so, last month it seemed that your preoccupation, if not your obsession with Sunny, cost you the WWF Tag Team Championship. With her not around now, can you get refocused and regain that WWF Tag Team title?
You know, how do you know she's not around? First of all, you know, as soon as I annihilate the Bulldog and Owen Hart and I win the Tag Team Championship, I know Sunny will be right back by my side.
Billy, it's us. We, together, we're going to win the tag team titles.
Whatever, but I know that Sonny's going to be right back by our side because I just have that confidence.
Forget about
Sonny,
man. Just forget about Sonny. I mean, we got a match.
Yeah, all right, Todd, let's get it on. Here they come.
All right, guys, good luck.
Todd Pettingill narrates a video package of the Smoking Gun saga with Sonny, planting the seeds of dissent between the two brothers. This video package was way more exciting than 6 months of tag team wrestling in the WWF. Doc Hendricks is with the Guns and questions Billy's preoccupation with Sonny. Billy seems to think he's the only one in the match, but Bart corrects him. How are these two not getting better on the mic? They get mic time pretty much every show they're on these days.
I don't think they've got it.
What's it?
The it factor. You know, that The Rock had an abundance and Bart Gunn doesn't have any of.
That's a shame.
It is a shame.
But Billy will get the it factor when he starts concentrating on his bottom.
Will he? He always irritated me when he was Mr. Ass.
Really? I thought that would be a character that you were really into.
No, because he was more focused on his ass than ladies' bottoms.
Are you waiting for Mrs. Ass?
I wasn't, but now you've mentioned it, yeah.
Another idea to ring Vince up with.
Mrs. Ass, three stages of heavens match, sorted.
Up next is a tag team title match between Owen Hart and the British Bulldog and the Smoking Guns. This rematch for the WWF Tag Team titles was announced on the 7th of October Raw by announcer Kevin Kelly, who I just want to add is way better on lead play-by-play on Raw than Vince.
I'll back that up. Yeah, really strange because I wouldn't have thought it, but it's actually quite good.
A short promo then aired with the Guns, continuing the angle that Bart was solely focused on regaining the tag straps, but Billy was way more concerned with regaining Sonny's affections. Sonny then dialed into the show, saying that if the Guns could win back the tag team titles, she would perhaps consider managing the duo again. Oddly enough, the new tag team champion's sole contribution to the last month of television would be a loss in a non-title match on the 13th of October episode of Superstars to the technically sound duo of Henry and Phineas Godwin.
Mm.
How bizarre. New tag champs, should we put them on Raw? Nah, probably just lose to the Godwins on the weekend show. Solid booking. The Smoking Guns enter to apathy as JR can't complete his sentence about Sonny being the most overrated manager in the history of the WWF.
Hmm.
Strong feelings on her.
Yeah.
Vince graciously apologises to the audience for the technical difficulties. Owen and the Bulldog enter with their lucky leprechaun, Clarence Mason. It was at this point I sort of wondered, Paul, did you travel back in time and book this show, as both of the opening matches have been heel versus heel?
Yes, I did. You've caught me. I apologise.
Very odd formatting of a show, I would say.
Mm.
Lawler says Clarence didn't finish law school. He settled out of class.
That was a very sharp comment.
Lawler, again, is very good on this, and I think he just about manages to keep it. In the opening of this, he managed to keep it from being too awkward, because the interactions between JR and Vince are often quite painful on a point, but Lawler's already got some smart-ass quip to shovel in there somewhere just to keep it light and amusing.
I think you're spot on there, and I think in many ways this is probably one of the King's best performances, because I think he's got quite a tricky role to play in this. It's certainly a bit different from his usual thing, because he's almost usually the person trying to, I wouldn't say derail, but...
antagonise.
Yeah. That's the word, isn't it? It's a good word. But, you know, he's really trying to play the in-between guy here, but also advance what's going on and tell the story of what's going on in the ring as well. I think he does a really good job.
Billy Gunn has another new haircut, moving on from his Dawson's Creek phase.
It was a short one, wasn't it? Did you ever watch that?
Yeah, Dawson's Creek, loved it.
I've never watched it.
Really?
Never.
That surprises me.
It seemed like the sort of thing I might like.
Yeah, no, I definitely remember watching that and being in love with Katie Holmes when I was like 14 years old.
Is it a bit like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but with no supernatural element?
Buffy the Vampire Slayer, only nowhere near as good.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Mm. Should I give it a watch?
Yes.
I'm a big fan of Baywatch.
It's a bit different to Baywatch. Billy and Owen start with a lockup, and Billy takes Owen down to the mat for a quick pin. Owen head scissors his way out and woos, but Billy gets out equally as quickly as Owen did. Back to their feet, Billy holds onto Owen's hair to hold onto a headlock, and JR references that also Owen has had a haircut.
Very astute.
Yeah. Which I didn't actually notice first.
It's,
off.
It's just had it quite short back and tides kind of thing, hasn't it? It's not as silly as Billy's.
Well, no haircuts are really as silly as Billy's. Mm.
Well, how would you rate his haircut?
Billy's kind of got like a girl's haircut. Owen's has got a sensible bloke's haircut.
Okay.
Certainly very 90s.
Yeah.
Billy takes Owen down with a clothesline and heads to the top, but Owen nails a punch to the gut. He tags the Bulldog and they double-team Billy with a clothesline, a drop toe hold, a leg drop and a wishbone, one of the most damaging ball-related manoeuvres.
What I loved here is when he goes to tag, he actually does a little run across the ring, and I thought that was a brilliant little detail that you don't really get to see in many tag matches, because if you're fresh and you want to keep on top, why wouldn't you run across the ring?
Yeah.
You never see it.
Billy finally makes a tag to Bart as Sunny looks on backstage.
She's watching TV at what I'd call that angle.
The WWE television angle.
Yeah.
Where everyone sort of stands at the side of their television to watch it.
Well, 45 degrees is the optimum viewing angle.
Now, when I see people watching TV on TV, it makes me think of Big E Langston with his white IC title, watching telly. I don't know why that is.
Because he did that once.
He did, but why does that stick in my head more
because we then took a picture of me holding my white IC title, watching him watching the TV.
That's why.
That was a good picture.
You look just like Big E Langston.
But Sunny backstage, looking very nice.
Yeah. Content from her facial expression, she looks like she's almost more on the side of Owen and the Bulldog.
Possibly. Mm. JR asks if she's wearing her nightgown.
Well, the cutback to a couple of times, and I mean, I didn't particularly pick up on it the first time, but when the cutback, she's wearing one of those dresses where it looks like a lot's covered up, but they're still quite raunchy at the same time.
Yeah, top draw.
The Bulldog takes the advantage on Bart with a side headlock and shoulder blocks before walking into a Bart power slam. About the most competent thing I thought the Guns did that match.
There's also a bit of commentary where JR's talking about a few too many trips to the woodshed.
Yeah, to do
about
with Sonny.
And then I think it's the Vince. King says, well, I think King says, what does that mean?
And Vince asks, what's in the woodshed?
And what does that mean? And what is in the woodshed?
I gather you get spanked in the woodshed for being a naughty child.
You need to ask the Divine Comedy.
What?
They did that song, didn't they? There's something in the woodshed.
I don't have a woodshed.
Me neither. Adam. And I've most certainly never spanked Adam in it if we did have one.
Is that what you'd use the woodshed for?
It depends how well you behave.
Well, we've not got a wood burner, so we wouldn't need it for wood.
Storing wood and spanking, apparently, is the function.
Yeah.
Bart heads to the top and misses a crossbody. Bulldog nails one of his own for a two count, and Bulldog tags Owen, who hits a lovely dropkick from the top rope and a bridging pin for a two.
Was that tag spectacular?
I don't know.
It was quick and smart, according to Jim Ross.
Owen tags back out, and the tag team champs hit a double clothesline before the Bulldog starts whipping Bart across the ring. Once again, we see Sonny and get a classic Lawler line, "Oh, baby, come out here, just wink at me, I'll do the rest."
And she does.
Yeah, fortunately for him, she winks. But what does that mean?
Yeah.
I'd like to hear the King's, his opinion of the rest.
And why does she need to wink for him to do the rest?
I guess if that's caught on camera, maybe that's consent.
Oh, Adam, you're walking a dangerous line there.
I think you should retract that statement.
Yeah, she winks and he squawks, I've got. In the ring, Owen applies a chin lock as the Bulldog shows off his muscles to Billy. Thought that was quite good. Bart bounces off the ropes right into Billy, causing the Guns to argue, and Owen rolls up Bart with the schoolboy for a two. Bart gets the advantage and tags Billy, with the duo hitting a double Russian leg sweep for a two.
I do like that. I mean, I think I said that a long time ago. But it's a good move. Why haven't they busted it out more recently?
Been too busy having bad matches.
Yeah, it's true.
Billy hits a neckbreaker as Sonny looks worried backstage. A tag to Bart, who hits a swinging neckbreaker for a two. And Owen plays face in peril looking for the tag to Bulldog as Billy comes back in and stomps away at the Slammy Award winner. Weird seeing Owen play that role.
Mm.
Lawler on Bart Gunn, He's been on so many blind dates, he should get a free dog. The Guns hit their crap-assisted corner splash and look for the sidewinder, but Bulldog sneakily hides behind Bart and pulls him backwards when Billy finally jumps off the top to hit the move.
Now, you say this is sneaky, but he's got his hands down the back of his trousers.
and it takes a long time, so he's there for a good 10 seconds.
Just with his hands down, the crack of his... Yeah.
Adam.
Do you want to do that sentence so that it actually goes somewhere?
I don't really think it was needed.
Adam, would you notice if some 300-pound guy had his hand down your pants for about 10 seconds?
I'd like to think so.
I'm fairly sure I would.
Anyway, the Bulldog pulls Bart backwards when Billy finally jumps off the top to hit the move. Bart and the Bulldog roll out of the ring as Owen quickly nails a spinning wheel kick for the three to retain the tag team championships at 9:17. Backstage, Sonny applauds the victory as the disappointed Guns head to the back. JR breaks down the reason the Guns lost, rightfully blaming Billy for taking a fucking eternity to hit their finish.
Why did he take so long? I know they keep banging about, oh, he's trying to look good for Sonny, but he was just faffing around, wasn't he?
He was waiting to make sure the Bulldog was in position, I guess.
He was checking. He definitely had his finger between the cracks. Thoughts on the match?
Not great.
I thought this was... Yeah, it's not great. I didn't think it was offensively bad, but it's a bit of a nothing match, very bland.
Yeah, see, I've got the same as with last month, mildly disappointing. And I'm kind of going to again place the blame at the feet of the Smoking Guns, whose split, I imagine you can guess, is fairly imminent. I couldn't really care less about.
Yeah.
I mean, I think one of the things about this particular match that did disappoint me a little bit was the actual finish.
Right.
I think the spinning kick perhaps isn't quite a strong enough move to
put pin someone... Billy Gunn.
Well, you know, he's been tag champ for
too long.
Yeah, too long. but yeah, I think you should have something a little bit more special.
Well, they haven't really got like a double team tag team finisher yet, have they, Owen and the Bulldog? So we'll see what they come up with to kind of use. Also, I'm pretty sure the rest of the WWF audience at the time agrees with me. They don't care about the Guns splitting up either. No. I suppose at least we're at the end of their run as a tag team now. Will you miss them?
No. The problem is that they lack charisma. Billy seems to have attempted to substitute charisma with shouting, which isn't really working.
I mean, and it's a shame because that comes straight from your advice manual.
Yeah, but he's just not got it. It's that it factor again. You know?
It is.
Now, when Scott Steiner shouts...
You believe it.
It's great. When Billy Gunn shouts, I don't buy it. And they've not got, bar a couple of double team moves, like the leg sweep, and like the sidewinder when they get it right, bar those moves, which are actually quite good, they've not got a great deal of exciting or innovative offence in the ring either.
To be fair, though, when we first saw them, I remember being kind of pleasantly surprised, not blown away, but I kind of thought, these will be all right, I won't mind watching these matches. Mm. And it's almost like they've gone backwards for me over the course. I don't know if that is just the quality of... Well, it could be the quality of some of the other wrestling improving, and maybe they've actually just been stationary.
Right.
But I actually feel that they probably have just regressed.
Have they been damaged by having Sonny with them and the spotlight clearly being on her and not on them?
Well, I think the entire tag team division was damaged by her so clearly being the focus of the division. I mean, I think the fact that the storylines weren't particularly interesting, the characters weren't particularly interesting, bar that one angle with Phineas where he finally got his revenge on Sonny, none of it's been great for a very long time. But do you feel kind of over the 3 years we've seen the Smoking Guns have contributed a lot?
They've contributed somewhat, but not a great deal to great matches, or even good matches. Actually, there have been a lot of matches that we've said, well, it was all right.
I would probably just say they've been filling a spot. I don't think they've really seized the opportunity.
So, final question then. Should they be commended for surviving so long as a tag team? Because you think, who else was around when we first saw them in episode one? You know, the match they were a part of contained, what, Money Inc., the Steiner brothers, the Beverly brothers? I can't even remember who was in the match.
God, but, yeah, they've been around for ages, haven't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, and, you know, who's come and gone since? They're Men on a Mission, Heavenly Bodies, Body Donners, all these other teams that have come and gone. Should they be commended for surviving that long as a duo?
I guess they've weathered the storm.
They have, but they've been so bland with it.
When does the tag division start to pick up?
It depends on your definition of pick up.
Do we see it?
Bulldog and Owen will definitely give us a better quality of matches, and certainly getting the titles away from that situation with the Guns, the Godwins and the Body Donners is a right move. You know, the second peak of the tag division is the year 2000, isn't it? So
yes,
we won't necessarily get that far, but I mean, we'll get the beginnings of the New Age Outlaws towards the end of 97. So depending on how you feel about them will colour how you view what we see at the end of our run with regards to the tag division.
Wait a minute.
Let's go back up to JR, who's in the ring. What is this?
And McMahon has—he's got his butt kissers to turn my microphone off, so I can't be heard on television. This guy right here—I'm not going to bore you or go into this story again of how he fired me twice and tried to ruin my life. I'm not going to go into that, but I am
going
to tell you one thing.
What is going on here?
That tomorrow night on Raw, thanks to good old JR, I'll guarantee you, I promise you, that Bret Hart is going to be live in Fort Wayne, Indiana. I promise you that.
He's taking credit to bringing Bret Hart back to make an announcement.
And it's not because he's coming back because you wanted him to come back. You didn't go to South Africa to talk to him. I went to South Africa. Right or wrong? Right or wrong? That's a yes or no for you.
You were in South Africa, JR. Yes, you were.
The issue is this. Tomorrow night, Bret Hart has got a lot to say. He said he was going to come back with a shovel because he's going to bury some people. Bret Hart has got a lot to say to you fans. He's got a lot to say to maybe Vince McMahon. And he's
what
got some other things, I think, for the World Wrestling Federation champion. Bottom line, Bret Hart will be uncensored tomorrow night. Now, seeing as though the egotistical maniac who owns this company has screwed up the microphones and he talks out of both sides of his mouth anyway. You need two microphones. You take this one. I'll see you tomorrow night on Raw.
Good catch, Vince.
Jim Ross heads into the ring and grabs a microphone to criticize Vince for his announcing problems. Vince gets boos when JR blames him for the issues. Are they booing JR or are they booing Vince?
I think they're booing Vince.
I was going for Vince, yeah.
JR promises that Bret Hart will be on Raw the following night. He takes the credit for Bret's return, saying he arranged it, not Vince. Apparently, Bret is bringing a shovel to bury people when he comes back. Shouldn't bother, there's a load down the aisleway.
Yeah, yeah.
Vince sits uncomfortably as JR throws his microphone at him before nailing his best bit of commentary ever. Nice catch, Vince.
Yeah, I think it made both of us laugh out loud, actually.
What a truly smug shit he is.
Yeah.
Referring to himself in the third person as well.
Oh, nice catch, Vince.
Yeah. It wasn't Ben Stokes.
Well, I don't think anyone will be for quite some time, but
that's referencing a great catch Ben Stokes took today.
But yeah, this sees the departure of JR from the announce table for the evening. Would you have liked him to stick around for the rest of the show, or, Paul, are you kind of glad that this bickering is over with?
I'm glad that the bickering is over, and I actually think they do a relatively good job getting other people in to plug that hole, for the most part.
I'm glad that he's out of the way, but not because of the way that he's commentating, but the deliberate technical problems that are happening are quite irritating. Because they're, it's like someone's there with a fader on his mic, just zipping it up and down and up and down. That's really irritating. And then they do something to
make it sound like it's on a radio.
Yeah, it's like some sort of like high compression or something. They're ripping onto it, so it sounds all wrong. And it's quite abrasive to the ears.
It's weird. I mean, I'm not a real kind of technical expert with any kind of audio, but it doesn't sound like natural interference or natural breakup. It's so obvious that it's manufactured.
It's someone with an off on button pressing it off and on, so it cuts out to sections of his dialogue. Yeah, so that was quite irritating. I would have quite liked to hear a bit more of the to and fro between them with King in the middle, actually, but just with working equipment.
Yeah.
So something we'll cover when we get to the end, but I'll just sort of touch on it now. What do you make to this blatant plugging of Monday Night Raw on a show that people will have paid for?
Is this a response to WCW?
Well, yes. I mean, everything's about the Monday Night ratings now, but do you think that's the right thing to do? I mean, they spend a good portion of the show plugging stuff that is happening on free television the following night. Would you feel like a mug for ordering this when all they're telling you to do is watch the following evening's TV show?
Yeah, it should be the other way around, shouldn't it? You should plug your pay-per-views on your free show, surely.
Yeah, but it's become this ultra-competitive Monday night environment where this stuff that actually doesn't make you a great deal of money, or in some cases I imagine is a lost leader, is what you're bothered about.
It's the kind of a fear that if they don't get the ratings on TV, that they'll lose their TV deal if they're falling so far behind the competitor.
I don't think it's necessarily that, but I think it's just the we need to beat them and they're saying the same back to us.
It's weird. I mean, I don't have a problem as long as there's balance, as long as there's enough big stuff happening on the show. And this has got the Buried Alive match, which is the focus of the show and certainly the bit that I'm most interested in. I don't mind them hyping bits of other stuff
for
the next night, as long as it's not out of control.
Because I guess it's a hype of someone's returning, isn't it? If they were putting a Buried Alive match on Raw, that would be a little bit remiss.
But if you were Vince in 1996, would you not think that Bret Hart's return is something the audience should pay for?
Possibly. I mean, it's one of these things, I'll be honest with you, I didn't watch that show thinking, God, I must go onto the network and watch the Raw that followed this match or followed this event. So it's not making me desperate enough. There's not enough big stuff happening to incentivise me.
Plus, there's always the odd thing I've thought about this in that the people that order your pay-per-views for all companies are a fraction of the people who watch your free TV show. So if they've paid for your pay-per-view, anyone who's willing to part with their money to do it is surely going to watch the free show anyway. So it's sort of an ass-backwards way of thinking in that, like you say, you should spend your free show trying to convince people to part with their money, not convincing people who were willing to part with their money to watch something for free.
That they were going to do in anyway.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a fair point.
That makes sense.
First, I'm glad that someone had the decency to wheel him in here in the chair tonight.
It was Farouk making reference to the presence of Ahmed Johnson, who was told he was here in the arena.
He knows I mean business. He and I come up along the same path. He knows that I'll do whatever it takes to get the job done, okay?
Not only do we have an occasion to chat with Farouk, but a little bit later on.
I can be on for the ride as long as you want.
There he was.
Farouk wants him. He know where to find me.
He's not quite ready. Not quite ready to make his return to the ring.
Farouk, walk it like I talk.
Well, then what's he even doing here tonight if he wasn't ready to return to the ring?
You know, brother.
I know what. I know. He knew what he was doing here tonight.
Let me
listen to this, please.
I didn't even know you at the time. You steps in the WWF and intruded in my territory, called me the belt. You called me something very important to me, Farouk. And I promise you, I swear to you, I will pay you back. You don't know when, you don't know where, you don't know how, but I will.
And indeed, ladies and gentlemen, he did pay him back. Again, there you see Ahmed in the locker room. What we are told now is that Ahmed was not necessarily the individual who provoked the attack. Apparently, there was something that Farouk had said or something that Farouk did to Ahmed. And again, by tomorrow night...
Oh, now who told you that, McMahon?
Footage airs from the free-for-all that we didn't see of Kevin Kelly interviewing Farouk before he is attacked by Hacksaw Ahmed Johnson. He had a 2x4.
Yeah.
Ahmed isn't ready to return to the ring, but says he'll take revenge sometime and he won't know how or when or where. So he obviously does it 10 minutes later.
Yeah.
Ahmed is a genius. Pleased to see him back on screen.
At the minute, there's nothing offensive to me about Ahmed Johnson. I find his promos hilarious. I find his in-ring antics wacky. He's not really upset me in any way. So yeah, I'd quite like to see him back.
For me, if I'm honest, this little hiatus is... hurt him a little bit, because I actually thought he'd got up quite a decent amount of momentum.
I'd agree.
Before, and it's like a little bit jarring in coming back now, because I'm kind of thinking, how does he fit into this mix again?
Well, bad news, because he's injured again, so he won't be back for even longer.
Ah, okay.
One thing that I do know about Ahmed Johnson prior to doing this podcast is that he was constantly injured. So yeah, I dare say we don't see an awful lot of him.
Bits and bobs every now and again. Up next is a WWF Intercontinental title match between Mark Merrow and Goldust. So we briefly mentioned the Intercontinental title tournament that began after SummerSlam due to the injury of Ahmed Johnson, so let's just cover off the full results of that now. Beginning on the Raw following SummerSlam on August the 19th, Owen Hart defeated the British Bulldog by countout when he allegedly had his head up Sonny's skirt. Continuing on Raw Championship Friday on September the 6th, Psycho Sid defeated Hunter Hearst Helmsley and Mark Merrow beat Steve Austin by disqualification. And rounding out the quarterfinals on the 9th of September Raw, Farouk Assad pinned Savio Vega following the Dominator. Both tournament semi-finals would be held on the 16th of September Raw, where Mark Merrow pinned Owen Hart after destroying his cast, and Farouk advanced over Sid via disqualification when Sid used a chair. Rather than holding the final at Mind Games, the WWF opted to hold the concluding contest on the Raw the night after, where Mark Merrow captured the strap, pinning Farouk with a Wild Thing after clocking him with Sonny's purse, which contained a brick.
Of course.
The fact that the new champion was crowned on Raw rather than the previous night's pay-per-view. Goes to show you the emphasis that is now being placed on Monday night ratings rather than drawing viewers to buy a show, as we just discussed. An Intercontinental title tournament final rematch between Mark Mero and Farooq Asad was set on the September 30th Raw, along with announcer Kevin Kelly acknowledging that on the previous weekend's episode of Superstars, Sonny and Farooq have had an amicable split. Neither Mero nor Farooq would do much of note on television, although on the 14th of October Raw, announcer Jim Ross would call attention to the headgear of Farooq being an embarrassment before sarcastically calling Vince McMahon a marketing genius. Basically saying, why would you take this all-American football player, former world champion, yeah, blah, 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 and put a blue helmet on him?
Who's very well known.
With Farooq bumped from the match due to a legit hamstring injury, Goldust is about as logical a replacement as anyone.
Yeah.
The upside for Farooq of getting a couple of weeks off television will be a repackaging that doesn't involve a blue helmet.
Oh, so we've seen the last of his headgear.
Blue helmet's pretty much done.
Fair enough.
Mr. Perfect's music hits for his second appearance of the show. Perfect has words with Jim Ross in the aisle and shakes his hand before heading to the announce desk.
I think JR is being seen as the face, and I think it's things like this that really get him over.
Well, yeah. Perfect's being positioned as a face now.
People love Perfect. This audience is really behind him. He gets a big reaction when he comes out, and if he's shaking the hand of JR, that means JR's all right.
But that's a bit weird, though, isn't it? Because if he's being positioned as face and he's basically stealing women...
Yeah, but he's perfectly doing it, so it's all right.
Okay, it's fine.
It's an admirable trait.
And he's stealing them off Triple H, so I guess he's a bigger dickhead.
So it's okay to steal a woman as long as he's off a heel.
Apparently.
Perfect says everyone knows why he is there, as Lawler responds, I don't. That was comedy gold. Vince plugs Perfect's upcoming match with Helmsley on Raw as Goldust and Marlena head down to the ring. She's lost her boob window.
But she's crafted, or should I say recrafted, like a mega mullet.
Okay, so, yeah, I've got down here that you said she's done something weird with her hair, but go on.
I think she'd done something weird previously with her hair. I don't really know what it was, but it wasn't a mullet, and now it is.
Goldust has a lot less heat than he used to, and it certainly felt like a responsive crowd earlier on.
Yeah.
Well, Wild Man Sable, what about it? A match made?
Hey, wait a minute. Let me ask him a few questions, McMahon. Hey, Wild Man! Huh? We see Farooq got back trouble. I said earlier, I bet you got foot trouble now. Are your feet feeling a little cold now that you know you're going to have to get in the ring with Goldust, huh?
No, Lord, I don't got time for you. My eyes are too focused on the match tonight. It's unfortunate what happened to Farooq, but Goldust will suit my doing.
Hey, let me tell you.
I'm the Intercontinental Champion of the world, and tonight I'm focused on one thing, and that's beating Goldust.
Yeah, because you've never done it before. Every time you've been in the ring with Goldust, you've lost, Mark Merrill,
and
you're fixing to lose again.
And you're the chump, buddy.
Thank you very much. Here they come, ladies and gentlemen.
Mark Merrill and Sable are standing by. Lawler jumps in to question Merrill, but Merrill disregards him and cuts a short, shouty promo. Lawler says that Mero has never beaten Goldust, so I guess that at least gives this match some sort of hook as a late replacement. Thoughts on Mero's promo?
Better. I think he's found it difficult to find his footing since he arrived.
Yep.
Doing something that's different from the Johnny B. Badd character. But I think he's gradually improving. He's certainly improving at a greater rate than the Guns have in their 3 years.
Yeah, it was an average promo. It wasn't special, it wasn't horrific.
Mero and Sable head to ringside. He gets Catherine wheels in the ring.
Yeah, but there's one on the right that doesn't go off and it just is linear. So it looks a little bit odd.
Lawler makes a gag about the sparklers setting Vince's toupee on fire, but Vince talks over it.
He also says that Marlena makes Sable look like a B-movie or Z-movie star.
Mero has the lovely white IC title, which is clearly the best one. Lawler says that Sable winked at the referee and fucked another referee in the hotel room the previous night.
He used those exact words.
He may not have, but that's basically what he says, isn't
it? Yeah, he does.
Goldust's outfit is once again bum-hungry as the competitors attempt to feel each other out early. Probably not in the way Goldust wants, though. Mero gets an arm drag, as apparently everyone agreed to open their matches with those tonight. Vader and Sid probably won't. Goldust gives Mero a rub on the face in the corner, and Mero shoves him away as Perfect plugs his match on Raw the following night. Mero gets an arm drag, a leg screw, an arm drag, a Japanese arm drag, and a drop toe hold into an armbar to keep Goldust down. Smooth.
Hmm. Yeah, I thought that Goldust wasn't on form again here, though, in the way that he took some of those moves. It didn't look as smooth as it should have.
He takes a really dodgy arm drag shortly after this sequence, doesn't he? But I think that sequence actually worked together really nicely.
Well, yeah, then Mero does a less than smooth arm drag, attempting to flip over Goldust's back, but Knight of Arm Drag continues with another Mero effort. Vince pervs over Sable on commentary. Lawler is less keen, offering, "I can't talk to her. It's hard to talk and gag at the same time."
When are we going to see Lawler completely flip turn his opinion on Sable?
I think we will see that, yeah. I think that'll happen at some point in 97, but that was a pretty funny line.
Yeah, yeah.
Goldust gets the advantage, beating Mero down in the corner as Marlena looks on nonplussed. Lawler says that Sable got lip injections like Goldie Hawn. They've gone down now, but at first they look like Mick Jagger after a bar fight.
Mm.
Goldust blows in Mero's face, and when the camera goes back to them, Mero takes Goldust down. It's kind of a really weird cut.
Mm. Yeah, there is a bit of an odd cut. I remember seeing that.
Does Lawler talk well about all the other women?
He talks well about Marlena and certainly about Sonny. He dreams about being her breastfed baby, remember? Yeah.
So do you reckon he just sort of like picked one that he was going to...
Well, no, she's the face, isn't she, Sable? Sable's the only one that's a baby face. The other two are
heels. Of course, yeah.
A sloppy head scissors and a back body drop, followed by a clothesline, and Goldust retreats out of the ring. Mero hits his flip dive over the top rope, as Perfect suggests that he helps Mero with his tactics.
I tell you what, that move to the outside, Goldust's head was really close to smashing back on the concrete. Really close, like it was a couple of inches away. That could have been quite nasty, I think.
It was good, though. Every time we see it, I like this flip over the rope. I think he does it really well.
Mero hits his slingshot leg drop back in for a two before heading to the top, where Goldust slams him off in a slightly better choke slam than The Undertaker managed on him last month.
That's exactly what I wrote. I'd also say it's one of the best moves I've seen him do in terms of actual wrestling on the podcast.
I'll also slightly bring up that we watched a Manami Toyota Takako Inui match where Inui was choke slamming Manami Toyota off the top rope in some quite fearsome manner.
Yes, like neck shattering manners.
Yeah, but the problem is, Goldust does that good move and he follows it up with another rest hold.
Well, that's his bag, isn't it? Goldust tosses Mero out of the ring and bashes his head on the steel steps as the referee looks on. Should that not be a DQ?
Probably should.
Lawler suggests that Perfect is interested in stealing Sable from Mero, probably.
Oh, on past evidence, yeah.
With Mero back in, Goldust hits a clothesline for a two and applies a chin lock. Lawler asks what Perfect has done with all of these women, wondering if they are in his garage. What the actual fuck is that where you keep women, Jerry? like that's not a logical thing to think, is it? Like, the logical thing to think would be he either took them out for dinner or banged them in a hotel room. the logical thing to think is not that he's taken these women and he's holding them somewhere.
Just piled them up in a garage.
Oh, the way he came up with one alternative and you came up with two very different alternatives as well.
But I felt mine initial ideas were more logical than he takes the women one by one and keeps them. That's not how life works.
Yeah, he delivers
it?
Them a killer perfect line and then says, "I'm going to drive you to my house," and then throws them in his garage where they meet all the other women that he's thrown in the garage.
Are you suggesting Mr. Perfect has some sort of Joseph Fritzl complex?
I think that's kind of where Jerry Lawler was going with it.
I imagine Jerry Lawler's got some sort of Joseph Fritzl complex.
No, you can't say that, Stuart. Cut that out. Literally cut that out.
No.
He's probably got a couple of bikes, a bag of cement gone hard and some smokeless fuel.
The announcing for this match is way more interested in the Perfect Helmsley match on Raw than the Intercontinental title match in the ring. Fortunately for them, Goldust has a chin lock on, so there's not much for them to talk about. Sable bangs the canvas to bring the crowd to life for Mero, which they do, giving Mero the impetus to hit a crossbody for a two, before he walks into another Goldust clothesline. For some reason, Goldust asks for a microphone. He tells the crowd to shut up, or he'll head into the crowd and stick his tongue down all their throats. That was random.
It was weird, wasn't it?
That kind of feels like a regression back about 6 months.
Is it because he's struggling for heat? He thinks he needs to get some... He does get some good...
Jeering?
He gets quite a bit of anger out of the crowd for that. He kind of does...
I maintain, though, business. If I was the crowd, I'd collectively call his bluff and be like, go on, then.
That'd take ages. How many people would you say was there?
Like 9,000.
Yeah, that would take a long time.
Mero uses Goldust's distraction with the crowd to take Goldust down with a back suplex before heading to the top rope and hitting a springboard moonsault for a two. That was nice.
Yeah.
Was this the awesome little flippity-flippity one?
I believe so.
That's the technical term.
Well, he starts
facing the ring.
Yeah.
He springboards facing outwards and then does a moonsault.
Yeah, that was nice. It was just like it's just that little twist on a relatively straightforward move, but just tweaking it just makes it 10 times better. Good for you, Mark.
That was patronising.
It wasn't.
Goldust sets Mero up for the curtain call, but Mero flips out of it and gets a rolling prawn hold for a two. Goldust tosses Mero to the outside and beats him down as the hideous mystery gender person does Goldust taunts.
Yes, they do, don't they?
That's a really horrible thing to say, though, Stuart.
It is a state.
I'm not wrong. We can't agree on what gender this person is, and they're doing Goldust taunts. It's not pleasant.
Okay.
Mr. Perfect leaves the announce booth and helps Mero back into the ring as Hunter Hearst Helmsley wanders to ringside to confront his Raw opponent. Goldust tries to attack Perfect from behind, but Perfect clocks him and Helmsley just walks to the back. End of that.
Yeah, that's random.
Yeah.
In the ring, Mero hits a Samoan drop and sets Goldust up in the corner. Mero heads to the top and hits the Wild Thing for the three at 11:38 as Mr. Perfect heads into the ring to celebrate with the Intercontinental Champion and Sable. Vince tells us that only in the WWF can you see this kind of athleticism, unless you watch Rey Mysterio, obviously.
I tell you what, the height on that move was absolutely fantastic, and he pretty much nailed it perfectly.
I think that kind of encapsulates Mero in general at this period. Like, there are things he is very good at, and he can do very well, but anything outside of those maybe four or five things that he's mastered, he comes across as looking a bit lost.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, you could say that about a few people, though, couldn't you?
Well, yeah, but I think it's kind of very noticeable with Mero, I would say.
I do like it. His shooting stars, really good. Does anyone else do it quite like he does? Because he does like this leg tuck thing as he flips up and over.
Yeah, and he gets a lot of height on it as well.
Does anyone do it like that?
Probably. I thought this was better than their SummerSlam match anyway.
I put this was good for a Goldust match.
Yeah, yeah. A bit disjointed as all Goldust matches tend to be, and weird to kind of see him regress to his mid-1996 crowd-baiting tactics. But Mero showed some good athleticism, and I think a relatively clean win here for Mero is quite important, as he hasn't exactly had a ton of those since he showed up back in April. Mm,
yeah. I wouldn't say quite liked it, but like Adam said, it was good for a Goldust match. I've been kind of conditioned to expect not a lot from these recently, and Mark Mero, funnily enough, brought out the best in him.
Well, better than pretty much anyone else has managed to so far.
Well, yeah. We've had a few months of really crap Undertaker Goldust matches, haven't we? We had the Goldust Warrior match. It's been a rough ride for him, shall we say.
One thing I will say for this match, I thought that Sable and Marlena were pretty much incidental. They didn't really do anything.
No, but Marlena's character tends to not do a lot.
And I think I've mentioned before, I quite like that aloofness of Marlena's character. I still think Sable's bloody awful.
She's certainly better than she was
back
in April.
She's better than she was, but I mean, there's a long road ahead, I think.
I also think it's quite important to have managers in this role where they're not always the centre of attention. You know, it just gets ridiculous, and sometimes you just need a manager to go out there and just stand on the side and do a bit of cheering.
I'm not saying that there should be
front and centre.
Yeah, or interfering in every match. But I don't think the problem with Sable, I think she still struggles to emote properly for it. So she's getting a bit of camera time, but she doesn't really emote in the way that she should do. She should look at some Paul Bearer matches and see how to actually emote.
I'd love it if she, like, painted herself white and started acting like Paul Bearer.
So would I.
I suppose it's about hitting that happy medium. I mean, we all love Sunny and she's been fantastic, but she tends to be the focus point of what she's involved in, whereas what you're saying here is Sable isn't, because there's nothing to kind of who she is or what she's doing. So I suppose it's about trying to find the happy medium between those, where you've got some kind of personality, but it doesn't overshadow the people you're managing.
You don't want to eclipse it, but you need to be there.
And there are examples of managers like that throughout history who didn't actually do much for their charges because they were too big of a personality. But then you've got ones who enhance the personality of the people they're managing. And yeah, I don't think necessarily Sable enhances Mero's personality. She just stands there at ringside looking blonde and large bosomed.
And Vince gushes over her constantly.
Bomb goes off. You're not the master of the powerbomb.
Uh-oh, powerbomb time.
This is trouble. Here comes
Between these two monsters began when Vader accused Sid of stealing his powerbomb.
The next time you use his move, just remember, Vader's gonna come and nobody's gonna be able to pull him
off of you.
Nevertheless, the debate rages on. Whose powerbomb is best? At 6'9", the height advantage goes to Sid.
There's no question that I am master of power.
But the Mastodon has 140 pounds on Sid, so the power advantage goes to Vader.
Psycho Sid, the irresistible force is fixed to come down on you, the master of the power bomb, and you rule nothing.
It's quite apparent that both power bombs inflict serious damage.
Who has the most powerful power bomb? Well, I've taken Sid's power bomb. And I've taken Vader's power bomb.
Here we go, here we go. The Vader insists it's over. He got it. Oh, the power bomb.
And to be perfectly honest, I was knocked out after both of them. So if you're asking the Heartbreak Kid Shawn Michaels, they're both equally as effective as far as I'm concerned.
At tonight's In Your House, Buried Alive, one man will be the master.
He's going to go through you like X-Lax through a Widow Woman.
Final extinction. Yeah, for you, Vader.
We get a promo package for the Master of the Powerbomb match between Sid and Vader. That, as a concept, just sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Vader batters a locker with a hammer and Sid does some whispering. Kevin Kelly breaks down the different height and weight advantages, and Shawn Michaels offers his perspective having taken both power bombs. He got knocked out by both, so he abstains from offering an opinion of whose is the most devastating. Full credit, yeah, this package made me want to see this match.
Mm, yeah.
Which is our semi-main event, Psycho Sid versus Vader in a number one contenders match. Believe it or not, on the 30th of September Raw, Vader pinned Shawn Michaels.
I don't believe it.
Clean.
I don't believe it.
100% clean.
Mm.
The show's main event would pit Michaels and sexy cholo Jose Lothario. I'm trying to come up with a gimmick for him. That's the best I've got. It would pit them against Vader and Jim Cornette in the tag team match that was once scheduled to main event September's pay-per-view. Towards the end of the match, Cornette attempted to swipe Michaels' feet with his tennis racket, but missed, with Vader proceeding to defeat the WWF champion with a powerbomb and a Vader bomb. When Vader attempted another Vader bomb after the match, Sid ran down to protect the Heartbreak Kid from the assault. On the 7th of October Raw, Jim Ross interviewed Jim Cornette and Vader. After Cornette tipped the hat to Ross for bringing Vader to the WWF, Ross announced that the winner of this match would go on to face WWF champion Shawn Michaels at the Survivor Series. Cornette queried as to why Vader would have to go through anyone to become the number one contender, as he had beaten Michaels at International Incident, twice at SummerSlam, and again on the previous week's Raw. Cornette also went on to claim that Sid had stolen the powerbomb from Vader, and Vader was set to deliver his own version to Sid to show that he was the true master of the powerbomb, a plot point that had first been raised between the two on Superstars in early September. During the show's main event, which pitted Sid against Goldust, and yes, Goldust did quote Psycho, brilliant, mm-hmm. Shawn Michaels was interviewed via telephone about who he'd rather face at Survivor Series, Sid or Vader, with Shawn offering that this was like being asked would he rather be hit in the head with a shovel or a baseball bat.
Shovel.
Really?
Well, not the sharp side.
Snow shovel, definitely.
Yeah, well, they're plastic.
Bigger area as well.
Yeah.
Shortly after this, Jim Cornette would come to ringside and join the announce team to once again profess the ridiculousness of Vader having to prove himself to get a title shot. After Sid picked up the victory, Vader would attack and hit Sid with a splash from the second rope, which Sid completely no-sold, getting up to chokeslam the Mastodon and send him packing. The October 14th Raw main event would pit WWF champion Shawn Michaels against Stone Cold Steve Austin in a match the announcers would sell as being the biggest match in Raw history. During the bout, Cornette would cut another promo on Michaels before Sid would cut one on Vader that involved a lot of shouting and laughing. The match would end via DQ when Vader interfered, with Austin joining in on the beatdown. Savio Vega would make a failed attempt at the save before Vader bailed after Sid ran down. As all of this happens, Diesel and Razor Ramon watch on in the aisle for no reason. In the ring, Shawn Michaels and Sid would argue after Austin knocked Shawn into Sid before the duo would fight off Vader and Austin once more as the show went off air. Worth noting here is that this show marks the first time ever the active WWF champion does not compete in a match on American pay-per-view. Yeah. Although the title hasn't always been defended on every show, the active champion has always wrestled on pay-per-view, with tag team matches, Survivor Series matches, and Royal Rumble matches accounting for the other bouts. And before anyone mentions it, the 1988 Royal Rumble wasn't a pay-per-view. Sid's music hits to a big pop, causing the audience to get out of their seats.
The audience really do love Sid.
I love Sid.
Well, I do right now, yeah.
Sid looks typically psychopathic on his way to the ring, staring and laughing. As he stands on the ring apron, the crowd go fucking nuts.
Yeah, he is white hot at the minute.
And, Paul, you mentioned it as you watched this match earlier, but have we ever really discussed Sid's music?
We've commented a few times, but it's genius in terms of it's one of those things that you can recognise very quickly and it sums up the character.
Yes, I'd really agree with that.
Within a few bars.
It's basically it's the psycho sort of like strings, isn't it?
Yeah.
Followed by this like deep foreboding riff. It's dead good.
Vader enters alongside Jim Cornette to a lesser reaction, although some little girl does give him a thumbs down. Because he's the biggest star in the match, Shawn Michaels comes out last, as Lawler wonders what he's doing there and says he's sick of the click.
Yeah.
How do you kind of feel about that? Do you think that's important? Like, if he is the guest commentator, should he wander down first? Or
no, I think he should be out before the competitors.
Yeah, I would agree.
Surely he's not the main event of this.
Yes, I think him coming out last positions him. I know he's the WWF champion, but...
But he's not wrestling.
I'll be honest, I don't particularly have a problem with it.
He enters the ring and shakes hands with Sid, but not with Vader. Cornette gets in his face, so Shawn uses his hanky to blow his nose. Devastating. Cornette bends over to pick it up, so Shawn kicks him in the derriere. Vader looks to clothesline Michaels, but Shawn ducks and he walks into Sid, who just stands there. Sid fires back with fists, not arm drags, a big clothesline and a fist drop as Shawn joins the announce team. Sid hits 5 out of 10 punches in the corner, and Shawn says, it's a good job, he couldn't count higher, and Lawler says, use your other hand. Is Shawn trying to project a character recently that he's an idiot?
It seems to be that way, doesn't it? There's a few kind of little nods to it.
Sid looks for a body slam, but Vader lays in a rally of stiff-looking punches and a clothesline.
Snug.
Lawler, for some reason, wants to know if Shawn will be having a haircut any time in the near future.
Yeah, I'll be interested in that.
Vader takes Sid down with a big splash in the corner and Sid rolls to the outside. Lawler says Shawn has a fear of big men, fee-fi-phobia.
That's also clever.
Lawler really is on good form again, isn't he?
I think we've established 96 is kind of great for Lawler.
He's on form consistently.
With the referee distracted, Cornette whacks Sid with his tennis racket. The referee's count makes 7 before Sid makes it back onto the apron. Fucking Sid hits a bloody sunset flip from the apron back into the ring.
Quite nicely.
Yeah, but Vader sits on him, which looks painful. But yeah, it's fucking incredible what Sid can do when he can be arsed.
Yeah.
Like, think how many crap Sid matches we watched in 95. And since he's come back and everyone loves him, he's like, I'll do a sunset flip.
What do you reckon he did? Do you reckon he sort of like, I don't know, went to see someone or had an epiphany, a moment of clarity?
Well, we've just covered this. There is no answer what came first, the chicken or the egg. Sid was over or Sid was good.
It's bizarre. Yeah.
Maybe if you want to settle on an answer, the crowd reactions that we can't explain why they're good motivate him to be better.
Yeah, I wonder if it was like a freak reaction. It just so happened that the first time he came back, he was in a place where a substantial portion of the audience...
For whatever reason.
For their own reasons, thought, fucking yes, Sid. And they just cheered the fuck out of him, and it just, like a flywheel, it just set him going.
Yeah, I think that's as good a theory as any. Vader tries a pair of stiff clotheslines to Sid's chest, but he doesn't go down. A third one works, though. Sid takes Vader down with a back suplex, and the crowd launches into a Psycho Sid chant. Vader punches away at Sid in the corner, but Sid reverses an Irish whip and hits a pair of what I've described as medium boots in the corner. They weren't big boots, let's be honest. Sid heads to the top rope, oh shit, and attempts a crossbody to Vader. But Vader catches him and slams him. What the actual fuck is going on?
Yeah, well done, Vader. You caught Sid. Sid's like, what, 300 pounds?
And near 7 foot tall.
Yeah, and you caught him. Nice work.
More of, say, a Joe Root catch.
No, mate. Catching Sid off the top rope is Ben Stokes.
Well, it wasn't like he had to go behind him and dive all
length. He didn't have to dive to catch it with one hand, no.
Catch Sid with one hand.
Have I ever told you the story? I mean, Adam's probably heard it, but have I ever told you the story about when I caught some toast?
No, go on.
It's a cracker. I was cooking some toast. In fact, I was doing cheese on toast.
Were you cooking bread or toast?
I was who thought you could do toast in the microwave?
Just hot floppy bread.
No. I was, you know, doing cheese and toast under the grill, and I just thought, you know, it looked beautiful, layer of melted cheese, and I kind of just about transferring it from the grill to the plate. And just as I was transferring it from the grill to the plate, I dropped it, and with cat-like reflexes, I managed to dive, and literally an inch from the floor with my left hand, I caught this slice of cheese on toast. I was like, that's the best catch you've ever taken. And then I realised it was cheese side down, and oh my gosh, the pain. And then I had to spend the next 15 minutes running my hand under the cold tap while I ate the cheese on toast with my other hand. But I can genuinely say that is still probably the best catch you've ever taken.
So continuing on your weird little tangent, this wasn't a catch. You saw it. I don't think you did. So we're in the pub one time, and one of our friends had bought a pint from the bar.
Yeah.
And walked towards the table that we're at and fell over. I mean, properly fell over on his face with a full pint, and then stood up and still had the pint perfectly in the glass.
That's good.
It was impressive.
I don't know how he managed it. How he just clattered to the floor, but somehow managed to move his arm around enough so that he didn't spill any of the drink.
Cushioned it.
Incredible. Most impressive thing this man has ever done.
You know, sometimes that happens, though. You know, it's difficult because often when you dive, you do a catch, your elbows hit the floor, and, you know, the ball will pop out. And it's amazing that the beer didn't pop out.
Yeah.
And
remarkable.
Must have had soft elbows.
Vader lands a splash on the canvas for a two. Vader drags Sid into the corner for a splash, which gets a two, but Vader pulls Sid up by the hair. Cornette has apoplexy at Vader doing this, so Vader does it again. Idiot. No one who ever lifts anyone up from a pin wins a match. Someone point it out if I'm wrong, and someone has then gone on to win a match, but Jesus.
It's the arrogant overconfidence move, isn't it?
Yeah.
That means that you lose.
Vader heads to the second rope and looks for a Vader bomb, but Sid gets his knees up and nails a clothesline and a scoop slam, bringing the crowd to life. Michaels urges Sid to finish Vader off. Sid sets up for the powerbomb, but Cornette gets up on the apron and tries to sneak into the ring. Sid, who apparently has eyes in the back of his head, crotches Cornette on the ropes.
That was absolutely genius, because, I mean, we were watching this together. And, yeah, absolutely right.
But basically what happens is Sid is facing away from the hard camera setting Vader up for a powerbomb.
Yeah.
Cornette gets up onto the apron. Sid in no way looks at where Cornette is at any point, but just miraculously turns to his right, shakes the ropes, crotching Cornette. It's genius.
Yeah, and even when he shakes the ropes, he's not looking at him.
Yeah, still hasn't even clocked him.
I guess this just shows how good Sid is at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, the crowd do react, so you might know that something's up, but that specific something was impressive.
Sid then hits a big boot that actually lands in Vader's balls and looks for the powerbomb, but Vader returns the ball shot in kind. Vader looks for a powerbomb but can't lift Sid up, so smacks him in the face instead.
Really whacks him.
Sid ducks a clothesline and hits a pretty decent chokeslam for the three at 8 minutes. Why no powerbomb from anyone?
Yeah, I've noted that because it's kind of billed at the start of this as the battle of the powerbombs, and there's no powerbombs.
That should have been a match stipulation, I think.
So I think we can just decide no one is the master of the powerbomb. False advertising.
Mm.
Michaels and his flowing locks leave the announce booth so he can get in the ring and milk some of Sid's heat. He taps Sid on the shoulder and they have a conversation with Sid pointing to his brain a lot. They shake hands as Sid laughs and pyro goes off.
Yeah, Sid got a decent amount of pyro.
Lack of powerbomb aside, this match was not too bad, really.
So a question, who is the master of the powerbomb? Who's done that? Who consistently has the best powerbomb throughout the history of wrestling?
Well, that might be quite a good question to pose to our Facebook group.
Yeah, because lots of people have done it, haven't they? Whether they've done it as a finishing move or whether they've just done it as an ancillary move, I don't know. But who does the best-looking, most consistent one?
It depends on what type of person you're looking at. So are you looking at the Vaders and the Sids and the Kevin Nash's of the world, or are you looking at, say, someone like Malenko, who when he powerbombs Ray, it looks particularly vicious? I mean, anyone can powerbomb Ray and it looked particularly vicious, but Malenko's always had a good snap to it, I thought. But yeah, maybe we'll get a discussion going.
It doesn't have to be giant guy, but because most people can do a powerbomb, right? Because it's a flipping momentum to drop, so it doesn't take a colossal amount of strength, and I guess, unless you're doing it on someone hugely heavy. But who has done the best one?
I was always quite fond of The Last Ride.
The Last Ride, now that's a different kettle of fish, isn't it? That does involve huge terms of strength because you've got to lift them once they're up there. And I really hated it when you ever, like Undertaker ever fought the Big Show, because as soon as the Big Show got in the position for the 10 punch in the corner, you're like, oh, they're going to call this as a last ride, and it wasn't. He just fell off the top.
I tell you whose I did like a couple of shows ago was DDP's on Chavo Guerrero, where he did that spinning powerbomb.
Yeah,
that was devastating.
That was, yeah, really was amazing.
The same show, Conan had a few decent powerbombs.
Yeah, good snap on those.
I wonder if it like really depends, you know, an awful lot on who's taking it.
Well, yes.
Who can take the best powerbomb?
I mean, yes, I don't know, you've probably never seen it, but there's one that Kevin Nash does on the Giant in, I think, 1998 that looks like it's going to break his neck. It looks fucking horrible.
Mike Awesome's
power bombs were amazing, yeah.
Particularly if they were on Spike Dudley. That remains one of my favourite matches, that Mike Awesome Spike Dudley one.
That's where he's like lobbing him through tables and from the ring to the outside. The ring, yeah.
Brilliant stuff.
Interesting, because lots of people have done them, so there's a wealth of them out there.
We'll get an audience consensus on it, see what people think. But yeah, this match, they didn't let it go too long. I thought 8 minutes is probably about right for this pair, and Sid retains his incredible overness at yet another pay-per-view. Yeah. And some of the stuff he was doing, like I say, cross bodies from the top and sunset flips, that's not Sid stuff.
Mm. No, that's not giant monster move, is it?
It's expanding his repertoire.
But, yeah, not offensive in any way. Actually, quite watchable, I thought.
Quite a fun little short match.
Yeah.
Is Sid Sean a match you want to see?
Yes.
Yes, actually, at the minute, I do.
Yeah.
Well, if you remember, I think it was way back at Raw versus Nitro 1 we watched that Sid Sean match, and I think we qualified that as being Sid's best match in that entire run. Mm. So I think a year on, and Sean certainly had a plethora of great pay-per-view matches and a motivated Sid. Yeah, I'll watch that.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, another Vader pay-per-view match, another one that he was supposed to win that he lost.
I don't know really where Vader's going anymore.
Or so goes the urban myth. There's two hypotheses as to why Sid wins this match over Vader. You ready?
Go on then.
Shawn Michaels.
First, the old chestnut that Shawn Michaels got the finish changed as he wanted to work with Sid over Vader, mostly because Sid's offense would be a lot lighter than Vader's.
Yeah.
The other version of the story casts the departure of executive J.J. Dillon as the reason for the altered ending. Dillon departed the WWF to work for WCW, and as such, probably would have been privy to future plans, including what the scheduled main event to Survivor Series might be. So in an effort to prevent Eric Bischoff revealing their headliner before they could, they changed the winner.
Ah.
Whatever the reason, there is definitely reason to think Vader was the originally scheduled victor. The television feud seemed to point more to Vader Sean than Sid Sean, with Vader having picked up a pin over Michaels in the weeks before, as we discussed. Yeah. Also, the December iteration of In Your House features the subtitle It's Time, a title which would have been revealed to pay-per-view distributors by this date, similar to May's Beware of Dog featuring the British Bulldog in the main event.
Yeah.
This kind of points to Vader being in a top spot on the show. Now, he might have been a challenger, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting stuff.
Mm.
I guess they didn't see, you've got to change the winner for whatever reason. I guess if you're in charge of it, if you're Vince and you're just looking at, well, fuck, just look at the reaction Sid's getting.
Yeah.
I mean, there doesn't seem to be a massive problem in changing that, because you're going to have a really sought after, a really hot main event anyway.
Mm.
You know what? I wouldn't mind seeing a triple threat main event.
Yeah, it's kind of a shame that we've not almost got into that era, because I think you might get something quite good out of those three.
Yeah.
New York, it's the city that never sleeps, and you won't even have time to sleep when the biggest superstars in the world take over the biggest city in the world. On Saturday, November 16th, it's the annual WWF Hall of Fame Banquet from the Marriott Marquis in Times Square, where the stars from yesterday meet the stars of today. Then Sunday, November 17th, it's the biggest pay-per-view event of the fall, the 1996 WWF Survivor Series, live from Madison Square Garden. We know these guys can survive the Big Apple. Can New York survive the WWF Survivor Series weekend?
Wow, what a weekend it is going to be. November 16th, the Hall of Fame, the inductees. My first Hall of Fame happened last year. Then the following evening, November 17th, the most famous arena in the world, Madison Square Garden and Survivor Series. And I guess we know what the main event will be right now. And I'm waiting on who will be the challenger November 17th. It's Survivor Series. Gosh, I'm excited. Psycho Sid meets... Yeah, what?
Let's not forget
Everyone, inviting everyone to join us live in the garden in the number to dial for Ticketmaster.
I was trying to do that.
I know you were. If you don't mind, we'll do it for you. 212, ladies and gentlemen, the area code of that's, of course, where the world champion New York Yankees is going to be. 212-307-7171 for ticket information, ladies and gentlemen, as to how you can be a part of Survivor Series at the world's greatest arena. And let's go back to Doc. Doc, you back there with Sid?
Yes, I am, Sid. Congratulations. I just got to ask you, how must it feel to know that now your destiny is in hand in November 7th?
Wait a minute, Doc. Just a more softball. Not no more McMahon question. Sid, let's lay it right here on the line.
Who is your question, little man?
I want to ask you a question. Why were you not at one time Shawn Michaels' best friend as bodyguard?
Yes, I was.
Did you powerbomb him 5 times on Raw?
Of course I did.
Will you do anything you can, including breaking his back, to become the WWF champion at Survivor Series?
The question is simple. Whoa. Yes, I will. I will do anything I have to go to my destiny and make my conquer to prove that I am the man. I am the master and the ruler of the world.
Thank you, Sid. Go ahead, Doc. Good job.
Thanks, Doc.
No problem with the microphone then.
No.
A quick promo airs for Survivor Series that promotes the Hall of Fame ceremony also. Cleverly, it now promotes the home video release. Well done. Doc Hendricks is with Sid, but Jim Ross hijacks the interview, which allows Sid to do some great shouting before he fluffs it big style.
That was a shame. That was more like old Sid.
Yeah, he sort of...
And future Sid.
He sort of gets going and then just has this mental block and stops and...
Yeah.
And then starts again and then walks off in a slightly angry fashion.
But I did like JR's participation in this because... The subtext was, he walks onto screen, says, fuck you, Doc Hendricks, and then just asks a load of subtle questions that really are...
Subtle questions?
He's blatant.
Yeah, blatant. Isn't
a it? Load of blatant questions. But I quite liked it.
And then condescendingly says to Doc, good job.
Yeah, and it stopped us having a Doc Hendricks interview, which have never been great.
What you've done, Mankind.
He's beating that casket with a steel pole!
You have awakened the beast.
Mankind, how did he get there? How did he do what he did?
Who has laid silent for a long time.
How did he get there? I don't believe it!
The Undertaker was inadvertently hit with his own urn!
I've destroyed the Undertaker! And the Undertaker, on one knee, as we've seen so many, many times before. The baddest man to walk the World Wrestling Federation. Oh, no!
Until now.
How could the Undertaker possibly understand what has happened here? What has possessed Paul Bearer? Wait just a minute! Look at this! Mankind up from the bottom of the ring! The Undertaker! Sucked down underneath the ring!
Psychological warfare.
Oh, wait a minute! From the other side! The Undertaker coming up from the depths!
Will be the demise.
The Undertaker's gone! The Undertaker's passed away!
Of Mankind.
The Phenom is here! The Undertaker and Mankind!
For every person who says, aren't you ashamed?
This resembles a prison riot!
You've destroyed the Undertaker's fans. You fought them, Payne!
They fought all over the building, apparently! What a war between these two!
I say it's about time!
Mankind and the Undertaker again going at it!
Mankind, I will dig your grave.
Paul? I don't want to be buried alive.
You're not going to.
You won't have a nice day.
This grave's too short for the Undertaker.
I am going to bury you alive.
A quick shot of the grave and we get a highlight package for The Undertaker and Mankind's near six-month-long feud, taking in all the major moments, including Paul Bearer's shocking turn. Again, this did a pretty good job of not making this feud seem stale, despite the fact that this is their third meeting in the past five major shows.
Yeah, this was, again, very good. And I think I mentioned at the start of the show that someone had discovered colour filters.
Yeah.
They've kind of gone overboard now. What is it was kind of, they had a colour for each of the competitors to show them as, you know, the angry antagonist or the more calm
protagonist.
Yeah. That now we get like this, you know, it goes from black and white to pink to blue to green to red to orange, just all over the place. I don't really know why it's happening. Good package, confusing colour filters.
It's time for our main event, The Undertaker versus Mankind in a Buried Alive match. In a somewhat interesting move, between the announcement of this match at Mind Games and the bout itself, The Undertaker and Mankind didn't show up on Raw at all, per se. Instead, their sole appearances would come in the form of weekly vignettes of each man in a graveyard talking about the Buried Alive match. These segments are fucking awesome and work really well as a different way to build up what is essentially a very different type of match.
Mm.
Yeah, I've seen quite a few of them. Really, really good.
My own personal favourite is the Mankind one from the 30th of September Raw, where Mankind is digging a grave with his own hands and offers the quote, "If I dig it, he will come."
We watched Wayne's World 2 the other night.
We did.
It's an interesting move, and I think it's one that lends itself very well to this feud.
Yeah.
In that both, well, certainly The Undertaker's got this sort of like mystical thing going on. They try and build up this character, and he's got powers, and he lives in a graveyard. It's kind of weird.
Yada, yada, yada.
Yeah. And the Mankind thing as well, you know, he's basically a nutcase that lives in a basement, and he's struck up a relationship with Paul Bearer. With Uncle Paul. And I guess having the produced vignettes like this actually keep that aura amongst both the superstars with it. Whereas if you have them out in the well-lit Raw wrestling ring,
yeah,
then it kind of puts them more just as ordinary competitors.
Yeah, and I think they kind of do more for the feud and the characters, like you say, than, you know, a six-minute Undertaker Salvatore Sincere match or a six-minute Mankind Aldo Montoya match might do.
And it builds the characters more. And more to the point, I guess maybe it keeps Mick Foley in some sort of more workable condition. If you have him resting every week, he's probably going to hurt himself in some way or be a bit more battered. You keep him in full form for the pay-per-view event.
The main event also functions as an experiment to see how a show can draw without Shawn Michaels in the main event. If there's a feud and two performers on the roster that deserve that slot, this is definitely the right one to choose. Aside from Shawn, Taker is the biggest star on the roster, and Mankind proved last month he can hang in a main event scenario.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mankind's theme hits, as Vince tells us that this is the World Wrestling Federation's first ever unsanctioned match.
What does that mean?
They're not having anything to do with it. It's completely off the books. They're not taking responsibility for it.
We're not having anything to do with it apart from it's going to be our main event.
And it's on pay-per-view with a referee in the ring.
Yeah.
Mankind enters along with Paul Bearer, who pulls his usual creepy faces on the way to the ring.
He gets described as bulbous.
He's not wrong.
this is an odd choice of word for a person.
Is it Vince that says that?
Yeah.
I think it is. It's just like, oh.
Bulbous Paul Bearer.
Taker's theme hits to a pretty big pop, although I wouldn't say it compared to Sid's. I thought Sid's pop was bigger.
Yeah, Sid's riding a wave at the minute, but this is still a massive reaction.
Taker makes his way to the ring, still sans hat and coat, and he instantly enters into a fist fight with Mankind. Vince tells us that the match will start in the ring and make the way down the aisle. Yeah, cheers Vince, we'd work that out because they're in the ring. So and I'd say that the other thing is down the aisle.
There's too much smoke from Undertaker's entrance, I thought, in this. It's like they're in the Yorkshire Moors. It's very difficult to see anything around the ring.
Undertaker lays into Mankind with rapid punches and knocks him to the outside. Mankind tries to grab Taker's feet, but Taker kicks him away, and Mankind goes hard, head first, into the guardrail.
Yeah, back of his head smashes into it. That was really sore looking.
We're like a minute into this match, and already he's taken the most hideous bump of the night so far. Taker then heads to the top rope and launches himself onto Mankind in the aisle, which pops the crowd and the announcers who sell it as never before seen. And although that sort of thing is established as part of his repertoire today, again, I don't recall us seeing too much of Taker diving off the top or diving over the top. Or
not that big a dive, certainly, because he does get some height on it, get some distance on it. He's a bit shaky up there to start off with. You see it quite well on the replay, and he does a good dive.
During our time period, we've seen a definite evolution of the character, haven't we? And the way that the guy is wrestling in the ring, so he's about twice as fast now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
As when we first started. And it just comes down to him facing more suitable opponents and moving with the times of the way that the company's going.
See, it's interesting that you say that. Two things I'm going to pick up on there. Number one, you said we've seen an evolution over the course of the podcast. That evolution has entirely happened in the last 4 months.
Yeah.
Mm, yeah, I guess so.
And you say against a variety of opponents. Mankind. No, well, that opponent is Mick Foley. Because he is the first character that we've seen The Undertaker launch into that fast offense and do this kind of stuff before. No matter who he was feuding with, be it King Mabel, Karma, Yokozuna, whoever, it was generally that sort of slow, plodding character that I would say, arguably, The Undertaker character was exactly the same when we picked it up in June 93 to June 96.
Fair enough. I guess that's my memory playing tricks on me.
I think it's interesting.
Does he go back to the slow, plodding characters at any point?
Yeah, when his knees start to hurt a little bit. Later in his career.
Yeah, later in his career. But from this point onwards, has he discovered something that works better and works with that? I mean, he has massive feuds with Kane, doesn't he?
Yeah.
But Kane's also
quite slow and plodding. Can be.
He's not King Kong Bundy. He's got more about him than that. I don't know.
Take your time and see. Obviously, we've got another 15 months of Undertaker.
Yeah, where he goes with it.
Taker marches Mankind down the aisle where the lighting isn't great. Mankind sees the grave and turns around, but is met by Taker's punches. I like the idea, as with anyone who faces Undertaker in a casket match, Mankind's afraid of graves, despite the fact he's spent 4 weeks digging one. The crowd pop for the competitors reaching the dirt. Taker grabs a shovel, but Mankind rams the butt of it into his throat. Mankind looks to suplex Taker, but Taker rolls him up in a small package and they roll down the hill.
I thought that was a nice little comedy spot, really.
Yeah, that looks like it might actually be fun.
Yeah, a bit of light relief in this kind of...
Why did he go for a small package?
To counter the suplex into the grave.
It was, I think, the logical counter, wasn't it? And they just kind of went with it.
Mankind backs away from the grave and they head back to the ring. Taker rams Mankind's face into the steel steps and they head back into the ring briefly before Taker punches Mankind out near the announcers. Taker follows and chokes Mankind with microphone cord. Lawler uses some sports reference about choking as both Taker and Mankind head into the crowd. Their stint there doesn't last long, however, as Taker lobs Mankind over the guardrail and Foley takes a typically nasty bump for it.
Yeah, it's one of those ones, I've got to say, it wasn't quite on the scale of the back of the head to the railings earlier, but again, do you think about the amount of these sorts of bumps that Mick Foley takes? It's quite frightening.
Taker follows, hitting a rather impressive clothesline over the guardrail. Back in the ring once more, Taker headbutts in the corner and looks to hit old school. Paul Bearer shakes the rope, though, and Taker takes at least 25% damage to the groin. If this was SmackDown, his groin area would have gone orange.
I wish on those games they did have a separate area for the groin.
I'll be honest, I didn't catch why he fell off. I almost felt that it just botched until you said that it was
Paul Bearer. Paul Bearer shook the ropes. Mankind takes over, kicking away at Taker and choking him while squealing like a pig.
I noticed the character, but that's like real screeching. It's just deranged.
Taker tries to boot Mankind away, but Mankind is relentless. Taker blocks an attack in the corner, but Mankind takes back over with some sort of wooden stake passed to him by Paul Bearer.
Well, I think it may have just been a pen or pencil, you know.
He stabs Taker in the head and rakes it across the dead man's face. And yeah, this is the point where I ask the question, if this is unsanctioned, why is there a referee?
Mm.
Also, why is the referee in the ring?
Yeah.
Yeah, their only purpose surely should be to decide when someone's buried enough.
Yeah, so what's the point in him being in the ring? He's not going to count any pins.
No.
The crowd picks up a rest in peace chant and pop loud when Taker gets Mankind away from him with an elbow. Taker picks up Mankind's object and clocks Mankind with it before hitting a jumping clothesline and a leg drop. Taker leaves the ring to go after Paul Bearer, but Mankind follows and grabs a chair from under the ring. Bearer looks to retreat down the aisle as Mankind attempts to clock Taker from behind. Taker works out Mankind's plan, though, and stops him. Bearer whacks Taker with the urn, but it doesn't faze him, and Bearer gets to do his comedy running away.
Well, I thought that whole stalking bit was quite nice, and it was nice how Taker telegraphed it, but then still kind of got his comeuppance quite quickly.
Unfortunately for Taker, he turns right into a chair shot to the face from Mankind, which the crowd oohs for. More rest in peace chants as Taker leans against the steps, and Mankind actually gets to hit his running knee to Taker's head.
I can't recall really seeing that too often where he actually connects.
Yeah, normally he misses.
I was wincing because I thought, oh, well, yeah. I know what's coming here. He always cracks his knees into it, but no, he actually hit it.
Mankind marches the Undertaker down the aisle and they climb the hill. Mankind punches Taker down and Taker falls into the grave as Mankind grabs a shovel and looks to start shifting dirt. Taker grabs Mankind by the throat and pulls him into the grave, but Mankind throws dirt in Taker's eyes. Taker lobs Mankind down the hill and they march back down to the ring, causing a low hum of boos. It's like, no, don't go back to the ring, stay there.
It was a real humdinger of a hip toss off the top of the grave.
Yeah, because he sort of slides down the hill.
Good distance.
In the ring, Mankind hits his pulling pile driver, which always looks good. Mankind looks for a pin, but Earl Hebner helpfully doesn't count, so Mankind pulls his own hair out instead. Taker fights back with a fury of punches, but misses an elbow drop. Mankind nails a double arm DDT on a chair and takes time to rock back and forth holding the urn. As he does, Undertaker sits up and whacks Mankind across the back with a chair before leg dropping it across his face.
He properly thrashes him with it as well.
Oh, wallop was absolutely the right word to use there. Thunderous!
Mankind heads onto the apron and drops Taker neck first across the top rope. According to Vince, this was what?
Oh, a clever manoeuvre.
Correct. Mankind brings up the blue mats and looks for a pile driver, but Taker lifts Mankind over his head in kind of an Alabama slam position and falls backwards into the steel steps.
Now, this looked like he actually sat on Mick Foley's face.
I don't think he did.
No, I don't think he did, but like it was that had a lot of scope to go very wrong, I felt. I thought it was a bit risky.
It's definitely something I've not seen before.
Yeah, definitely different.
Taker tosses some of the steps into the ring, and when Mankind enters the squared circle, Taker throws them in his face and clocks him round the back of the head with them. Taker signals for the tombstone and hits it before signalling it's time to take Mankind to the grave. He puts Mankind over his shoulder and carries him down the aisle, dumping Mankind on the hill. Mankind suddenly comes back to life and applies the mandible claw. Paul Bearer throws Mankind the urn, but Taker blocks it and chokeslams Mankind into the grave to a big pop.
That must have really hurt.
Mm.
That's quite a way down.
Well, it's not as deep as you'd think, because you kind of you see a grave and you think it's going to be 6 foot deep. So kind of, I don't know if graves are actually that deep or if it's just a standard cliche. This isn't 6 foot deep. I
still think it'd hurt.
Smart a bit, yeah.
It's probably less forgiving than the ring.
Taker begins to shovel dirt into the open grave as the crowd pops, and the referee declares him the winner at 18:25. Apparently, that was a sufficient amount of dirt from dirt expert Earl Hebner.
I was wondering, like, how much do you have to... Is it subjective to the ref?
What volume of
that's
soil?
Probably, that's probably enough.
Yeah, does he get like... You know, like when you're testing if a chicken's cooked all the way through, you're like, does he like dip something like that in the mud and go, yep, buried alive, definitely. Yeah.
What, if his steak comes out clean?
Yeah, if you lift the fork back out...
The cake's ready.
Well, yeah, maybe that's it. If you stick a fork in the dirt and it doesn't come back with Mankind's blood on it, he's buried alive.
Yeah.
Referees try and stop Taker from his spot of gardening, but he throws them off the hill. Proper throws them.
Yeah, he batters a couple of refs.
Yeah, it was a bit of a procession.
I suppose this is, you know, the first example of Taker really doing his job on camera.
Yeah.
Like, every now and again you would get the vignettes of him, like, building caskets, but presumably this is his day job.
One of the things that I was wondering about here is when you see the grave, it's got lots of roots on the side where it looks like they obviously dug down and they've had to cut through some roots to get down there. But what plant have those roots come from? What tree?
Some sort of mysterious kayfabe plant.
The dreaded arena tree.
Out of nowhere, however, a masked man hits the Undertaker with a shovel and begins to unbury Mankind under the instructions of Paul Bearer.
Who is this man?
Well, Adam asked me a question.
Who's that guy in the executioner mask?
Is he the executioner?
Turns out he is. Mankind crawls out of the grave and the masked man throws the Undertaker into it as thunder and lightning sound effects fill the arena. Mankind and the masked man shovel dirt into the grave and they do a remarkably quick and efficient job.
Can I be pedantry here? You said thunder and lightning sound effects, where it's really just thunder sound effects.
Apologies. The crowd roar, rest in peace, as Goldust, Justin Hawk Bradshaw, Crush, and Hunter Hurst Helmsley show up to help.
Is this the first time that Triple H has buried someone?
I guess this is his first opportunity, yes. But I can't help but feel I've seen a scene a little bit like this before, only with more Marty Jannetty.
When everyone came out to put him in a casket.
Yeah, pretty much. Fans helpfully throw drinks at the scene, WCW style.
Well, yeah, lots of coke lands in the grave and Vince is talking about it's gotten out of hand. But it feels to me like the crowd are just helping to bury Taker, but it's turning into some kind of mini landfill site.
Full of coke cups.
Yeah.
Paul Bearer seems happy with this entire development anyway.
We also find out that Mankind is somewhat of a perfectionist in terms of levelling off the soil in the grave.
Perhaps he's auditioning for a job as an undertaker.
Trying to impress Paul.
The burial kind of takes a while, which loses some of the heat from the situation. Bearer cackles to Mankind that the Undertaker is gone, and Lawler has a good laugh about it too. Out of nowhere, the thunder rumbles again, and the gaggle of low-carders leave Mankind, Bearer, and their new pal to finish the job. Mankind jabs his shovel in the dirt, and the trio leave. A job well done. Coliseum home video exclusive brings us a happy Paul Bearer as Mankind rocks on the floor. Mankind shouts creepily about not wanting maggots to eat his lip.
Okay,
it's fair enough.
Paul Bearer introduces us to their new man in red and black, the Executioner.
Who is the Executioner?
So, unless Pat Tanaka grew half a foot and put on 70 pounds, it most certainly isn't him under the mask. Instead, the Executioner is in fact former Fabulous Freebird Terry Bam Bam Gordy, widely regarded as one of the best big man wrestlers of all time. Gordy, alongside Michael Doc Hendricks Hayes, formed the faction early in 1979, adding Buddy Roberts later that year to form one of wrestling's very early gangs, so even kind of prior to the Four Horsemen you had the Fabulous Freebirds. Most famous in Dallas's world-class championship wrestling for their feud with the Von Erich brothers that began on Christmas Day 1982, the trio also competed in Georgia Championship Wrestling, Mid-South Wrestling, the AWA and World Championship Wrestling, along with a stint in the WWF that lasted a grand total of 8 matches over 2 months before they were fired for arriving late to a television taping. Famous for their use of Lynyrd Skynyrd's Freebird as their entrance music, the group recorded an original composition to use as a theme in 1984, entitled Bad Street USA.
That's awful.
Do you not like that song?
There's a certain cheese factor that's interesting, but no, I don't think it's great.
Well, it also had a music video that is painfully 80s, which I thought you would like. They also featured in the opening sequence of the 1986 film Highlander.
Yes, they do. I love that film.
Gordy also gained fame internationally in All Japan Pro Wrestling as part of a tag team called the Miracle Violence Connection with Dr. Death Steve Williams. Highly recommended from this era is a match this duo had with the Steiner Brothers at WCW's Beach Blast on June 20th, 1992. As you can imagine, if you've ever seen the four men in this match, it's basically four big bastards tossing each other around and hitting each other as hard as they legally can.
Fair enough.
Sadly, in 1993, Gordy took an overdose of pain medication on a flight from the United States to Japan and slipped into a coma, suffering brain damage, which he allegedly never recovered from. In June 1996, he would appear as a surprise for ECW at Hardcore Heaven to challenge Raven for the ECW World title. Raven, who would later recall Gordy's appearance as the loudest pop he ever heard in the ECW arena, lets Gordy absolutely batter him in what is another memorable outing that is well worth tracking down. Gordy would stick around in ECW right up until this appearance and is the first of a number of ECW performers who will show up in the WWF over the next few months. Back in the arena, the crowd boo as lightning strikes the gravestone and the Undertaker's purple gloved hand sticks up out of the dirt as the show ends.
Well, it doesn't, though. It sticks up right next to the gravestone out of a bit of turf.
Yes, it
does. Now, I seem to remember when Undertaker was tossed into the grave that his head was not at the headstone end.
So he's managed to do a bit of tunnelling.
I think so. I'm sure it was him that his hands were kind of under his head, probably trying to protect his face from the soil. Yeah, but his head was at the wrong end. And how his hand would get there, I've got no idea. So I am intrigued as to how this works in terms of burying the person but not
killing them
and how that hand thing works. So I'm presuming it wasn't his hand. He wasn't even wearing that glove, was he?
Holy shit, what if it's Marty Jannetty's hand?
Oh, it could be, couldn't it?
There's a point where we have a cut away. So we have them throwing dirt on top of the Undertaker. Then we have a cut away to the top where you can't see down in the grave, but you can see what's happening.
Yeah.
And then it's there for like 15, 20 seconds. And then it goes back, and when the dirt's being put in, it's a flat bed of dirt that's going up.
Yes, it is, yeah.
So I can only assume that...
At some point, there's some sort of trapdoor that he's escaped from.
Yeah, or there's some sort of, like, board that comes across.
See, I was thinking board across would be a more likely
option.
Because you've got to think that the way that it's positioned, there's no one in the crowd that's going to be able to see in there.
Yeah.
And if you just keep the cameras out of looking at it, you can do whatever you like. And, at that point, they've changed it. How the hand comes out, I don't know.
Apparently, we also missed the scene where they threw pig's blood over the Undertaker at his school prom.
What? Oh, good Carrie reference.
This entire scene is stolen, from two movies, really. Carrie and Deliverance. You ever seen either of them?
No.
I can't imagine they'd be Mrs. Scrivens approved. Anyway, I like this match way better than I expected to. And I would go so far as to say I think it's Mankind and Undertaker's best outing together yet.
I think, really good stuff.
Fabulous little match.
And interesting gimmick as well. I was from the first outings of these big gimmicks to be quite intriguing to look at, to see how they do them, how people react to them, because of a historical context maybe.
Yeah, I've seen a few since that I've not been so big a fan of, but this was a good match because they used the gimmick a bit, but sparingly. You know, they'd tease it early on, but they'd go back to the ring and they'd do some solid in-ring work before kind of taking it back up there. And they're not spending too much time at the graveside, which can be a bit of a downer on these matches.
See, we've witnessed over kind of 3 years of crappy Taker gimmick matches, so there's good possibility, I think, that we actually went into this with low expectations. But I think this stands up today as one-off, if not the first sort of Attitude-era style walk and brawl main event.
And this was way better than all the casket matches that we've seen, right?
Head and shoulders above anything we've seen before, sort of gimmick-wise, from Taker.
Hmm.
As ever, Mick Foley worked damn hard to kill himself for our amusement and took some nasty bumps, particularly the one where his head went into the guardrail.
Yeah.
Okay, the ending, while being ever so slightly derivative of the much-maligned Royal Rumble 94 finish, worked pretty well here, and the final image of Taker's hand rising up through the dirt is pretty cool, even if that is stolen as well.
Yeah. Hmm.
And you get the little effect of lightning hitting the grave.
I think this was preferable to the casket Undertaker's rising to heaven type fiasco.
Was this a nice change of pace from Shawn Michaels' main events?
It was different.
I don't mind. Look, I think as long as you've got a good main event, I think it's okay.
Yeah.
And this was definitely a very good main event. Yeah.
I've got no problem with seeing Shawn Michaels' main events. They're normally pretty amazing.
But that's what I'm saying, because they have been good. Was this a nice change of pace?
This was a worthy substitution, shall we say.
In dark matches held after the show, the Godwins defeated the New Rockers, and Shawn Michaels did actually wrestle, successfully defending the WWF title against Goldust. So bravo, Goldust. You went for two singles titles in one night and failed to capture either. I thought this was a fairly decent show overall, and for an in-your-house event, time flies by, I thought. The main event is pretty good. The opener is one of the better matches from 1996, and Sid Vader and Goldust Mero are both decent. I think the only real dud for me is the tag match. If there's one negative to the show, and as I mentioned earlier, I'm not sure if it even qualifies as that, it kind of half feels that the show just exists to promote the following evening's Monday Night Raw. I know we're balls deep in the Monday Night Wars, but I think if you added the much-plugged Bret Hart interview and the supposed Helmsley perfect match to this show, this would be even better.
Yeah.
There are definitely worse ways to spend 2 hours watching wrestling than checking this out.
Yeah, a decent pay-per-view effort. There was nothing on there. Like you say, I mean, the tag match was a bit of a dud, but it wasn't enough to derail the whole event, and it was generally of a decent quality, I thought.
I thought it was average up until the same main event, and from there it went up and then up more, which is what I want from a show. So overall, it was good.
So, match of the night at MVP, then?
The main event is the match of the night for me. But I will put in a strong word for the Stone Cold match, because I thought that was actually really good, despite Paul's misgivings of it. I actually thought it was pretty decent.
I'm not trying to be funny with it, but like, I just don't get what was entertaining about that match.
I guess it's kind of personal preference, yeah. Isn't it? MVP's a bit more tricky for me. Taker and Mankind both did a really good job. Thought Stone Cold did a really good job. I thought that Mero did actually a really good job. He managed to drag a semi-decent match out of Goldust, and we've not seen that great a reputation amongst his past matches that we've seen. I'll probably give it to Undertaker.
Okay.
I will do for, you know, stepping up and doing something really quite cool.
I would agree. Match of the Night's got to be the main event. I think my special mentions would definitely go to Mero, because I think he did a few really good moves in that match. I'd have to single out Sid for another really quite promising performance. Undertaker and Mankind were also both great, but I would give it to Mankind.
Okay. Yeah, match of the night, Undertaker versus Mankind, although Helmsley and Austin was pretty decent, and Vader, Sid was pretty good for what it was. And I think this is probably the first time again where two shows on a row, we've all had the same match as match of the night.
Mm.
And both times they've been Mick Foley matches.
Yeah.
And for my MVP, I'm going to go with Mankind again, because I thought, again, he kind of really proved he belonged in that main event scene. And yeah, he seems determined to sort of lob himself about for our amusement and take these really horrendous bumps and does some great character work. And yeah, really belongs at that top of the card at this point.
Yeah, I just think that his work ethic is so good. His characterization is so good, and it's really been a very welcome injection after an awful 1995.
And mullet of the night.
There was a guy in the crowd during that Sid Vader match,
yeah,
which was just awesome. Like really, really good effort. But I didn't see that for long enough. So for the second time, it's to Marlena for crafting something really just massive.
There were a few on show tonight, though. You know, you got Miro, you got Sid.
Yeah, but there's nothing changing about their ones.
They're not evolving.
They're not evolving.
But yeah, that guy in the crowd was pretty good. And you got sent some nice ones on Facebook as well by people.
Yes, actually. And I think you put up a picture of Pat Sharp, didn't you?
I did.
Which was great. And some of the additional pictures that were posted up as comments to that were splendid. Particularly Andre Agassi.
I knew you were going to say Andre Agassi.
I'd forgotten just how bonkers that haircut was.
And on that bombshell, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/NewGenerationProjectPodcast. We are also on Twitter
at the Shuffletastic
New Gen Podcast. You can, as ever, rate, review and subscribe for all of our episodes as soon as they are available in iTunes. If iTunes isn't your thing, you can check out new episodes on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/NewGenPodcast, on Stitcher Radio or on piledriverwrestling.net. If you just found us and want to catch up, our back catalogue is going up one by one by one on botchamania.com, and adding to our list of affiliates, our back catalogue is going up on Inside the Ropes, and you can check out some of their audio over on our SoundCloud page. Calling Spots issue 16 is now available at callingspots.com. If you've enjoyed the last 6 or so episodes that we've done, then you may want to check out my article in this issue, as it documents the summer of 1996 and two of the biggest moments in wrestling history happening merely weeks apart. There's a ton of other great stuff in there for just $1.99 an issue plus postage. Subscriptions are also available. You had a chance to look at yours yet, Paul?
I've not yet, but I'm eagerly awaiting a chance to read it. Maybe tomorrow I'll sit down for a few minutes and start making my way through it.
And if you have a little extra spare cash, head on over to newgenpodcast.bigcartel.com to pick up a Scrivens 3.14 t-shirt for just $12.99 plus postage. Or if you just fancy checking out a Total Divas episode on its own, head over to selfie.com/newgenpodcast and pick up our second Total Divas review for just $1.99. Episode 44 will be... No, wait, Brian Pillman's got a gun.
What?
You heard.
I think I've seen clips of this.
Yes, it's quite a famous angle, and we couldn't exactly pass over that without covering it. So, yes, we'll be talking about the Pillman-Austin gun angle.
So is this a Raw one?
This is an episode of Raw, yes.
So Raw versus Nitro 4.
Indeed.
The nightmare continues.
My name is Stuart Brooks. I shall say see you later.
I'm Adam White. Goodbye.
I'm at Yes Paul Screens. Bye. Yeah.
take it easy, throwing far too much emotions at me. They fool to see they're falling. I'm gonna make you understand. I'm giving you everything, all that joy can bring. This I swear, give you everything. And all that I want from you is a promise you will be there. Say you will be there. Oh! Say you will be there. If you put two and two together, you will see what our friendship is for. Oh. If you can't work this equation, then I guess I'll have to show you the door. There's no need to say you love me. It'd be nice. It would be better left unsaid. I'm giving you everything, all that joy can bring. This I swear. Yes, I swear. All that I want from you, it's a promise you will be there. Harmonica solo is harder with your voice. Be cool and be there falling. I'm gonna make understand. I'll give you everything on this, I swear, just promise you'll always be there. I'm giving you everything, all that joy can bring. This I swear, yeah, I swear. All that I want from you,
want from you,
promise you,
promise you,
there.
Always be there.
Giving you everything,
yeah, I swear.
All that I want from you,
want from you,
promise,
promise to give
me, giving you
everything, give me everything, yeah, I swear.
Very good song.
That's wonderful.
Thank you. I particularly enjoyed the maths.
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Oh, shit.